Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
Jake, this was an interesting show because it seemed to feature AEW, kind of the next generation of AEW original pillars, with Hook's win, Dante Martin's showcase performance against Sammy before losing, and Danny Garcia getting a non-clean but still noteworthy win, an upset win over Bryan Danielson. That came across to me as the story of the show, and I don't know if that's the story they were going for, kind of tying those three together, but in a general sense, it felt like a concerted effort was made to say, you know, kind of who are our next pillars and let's feature them, not necessarily, well, in Hook's case and Garcia's case, win, and kind of feature them and have kind of established that we're committed to these guys, or we at least are showcasing them and preparing them to be future pillars. Did that jump out to you at all, or do you think some other, you know, multiple shows kind of come across that way, and this wasn't necessarily a standout in that regard?
Well, I think having it all happen as, you know, in quick succession like it did certainly makes it stand out. It's just a matter of commitment, right? How well can you consistently stick with setting up talents like this as your next pillars? Because it wasn't that long ago that we had a different set of pillars who they were kind of putting as the next generation, who I don't think they've been entirely consistent about keeping in the forefront. And so, I guess you could call it a, you know, sort of an emergence show for a couple of folks, but I guess time will tell whether or not the booking allows for them to consistently get that kind of exposure.
Well, what do you think of those three? If we are to, you know, play up the theme that I am introducing here, to me, there are three wrestlers where if I think AEW commits to them and does things, it's subjective, but does things correctly going forward, in the sense that there's some consistency and planning and strategy, are they three good picks in terms of kind of establishing this is sort of the class of 2022 in AEW? If we had the original four pillars, well, you know, we're a few years in now. It's time for AEW to send the message. We've got some other young talent that is really talented, and are they making the right choice as far as that, if these are three that they are committed to? And I kind of want to throw Ricky Starks in there too. He's in his early 30s, but and he's been around a lot longer than those guys. But as he said, you know, he's been waiting around for his opportunity, and I think he could be talked about for the next years in the same way that these three would be if Tony Khan did commit to them.
Yeah, I think if we're going to call out Garcia and Hook, and were you calling Dante Martin the third in that regard?
Yeah, three guys in their early 20s who all were featured tonight.
Yeah, I think, you know, they've all shown that when they're on in the ring, they're, you know, they can compete with top flight talent, and they can look very good in the process of doing so. I think the, you know, where AEW really needs to focus, and even on the pillars that they were pushing as their 2021 class, they still have a lot of character work to do before, you know, they really reach that next level where, you know, you're kind of piercing the veil of an audience that isn't currently watching the show. You know, I think AEW does a really good job of putting its young talent forward and giving them exposure. But it's, you know, how do you really attract a younger audience? And I don't know if it's necessarily with, you know, I mean, they packed a lot of ring action into a 2-hour show. I think there were 7 matches on this card, and I think they could have spared a couple of them and done a bit more character work. At least that's sort of my general thematic issue with AEW at times, is that the in-ring action sort of pushes the storytelling off the show. And unfortunately, I don't think growth is going to come without more storytelling in general on this brand.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, we had Yamashita in a world title match, and her familiarity, the audience's familiarity with her was, you know, a single cam footage from across the ocean of her getting an upset win. Not a lot of chance to bond with her or take her seriously as a contender. Or if she were to score a surprising upset win and win the title, not enough of a backstory to really know even where to put that. You know, there's not a lot of buildup to that moment. And then you had Roosh, you know, in a match where it's like, oh, here's something, you know, here's something he did on the pay-per-view. Here's a match he won on Dark or whatever they showed. But why is he getting an interim title opportunity? Why is he getting a title shot against Moxley? It's based on, wouldn't this match be cool because of what hardcore fans who know Roosh would imagine a Moxley-Roosh match being? And so much of the booking does seem to be like dream booking from Tony Khan and Excalibur, you know, like a dream show for them that everybody just gets to watch if they want. And that commitment to building the characters on this show for the matches that were featured with the title on the line, those two in particular, is an AEW weakness, I would say. I think they would be better off putting more time into that. One of the strengths was that Ricky Starks vignette, although the timing of showing him being rich and snooty and wanting the fine things, which came across heelish, it's kind of a weird time to introduce character development as a heel when 8 minutes later, 12 minutes later, whatever, he's going to turn babyface.
Yeah, I guess you couldn't really give it away at that moment either. But I think at least the production values for that video package were very good. It came across very professional. And I wish they would do more of that. You know,
yes.
More, even if they're only 15, 20 seconds, like, give me more character. Breathe some life into these matches. You know, I think that's really what is missing from the show a lot of times for me personally. It's not, I mean, I have no real complaints about AEW's ring work most of the time, other than, you know, I wish there was more selling from time to time. But in terms of character development, I think it's just missing. Like, Ricky Starks maybe had the best night of anybody because he got to clarify, you know, where he's going next and talk about, you know, where he you know, views himself, how he values himself as a wrestler, you know, his direction. And then you kind of really, you know, kick off his future with, you know, with that attack from Hobbs and where they're going with those two. And so, yeah, it was certainly the best night of Stark's AEW career in terms of building a character for him. And I'm optimistic for where he's going. And I think they did a nice job of transitioning that title onto Hook, who I think benefits from having a title that's sort of a quasi championship. You know, it's one of those things where he doesn't have to be put into positions where he's not ready. You know, the FTW title is, you know, for all of its negatives in the sense that it's, you know, it's not an officially sanctioned title and whatnot, it's something that, you know, allows him to carry some prestige without being pushed into positions where he's doing too much too soon. And so I like that move for Starks. I like the move for Hook. You know, Dante Martin is going places, but I felt like that, you know, for all they accomplished in that match in terms of doing some really impressive things aerially, the post-match was just a mess and didn't really work for me at all. And the Garcia and Danielson win, it's big. Like, you know, getting a win over Bryan Danielson is big, even though I'm not 100% thrilled with the idea of using head trauma to tell a story in wrestling. I think that's a mistake, personally.
I agree. You know, I don't even like Ricky Starks grabbing his neck all the time. I don't know if it's really hurting him, but there's people who consistently say, oh, I don't think you should invest in Ricky Starks because of his neck. And, like, why play that up if that's not really an issue, if it's going to make people think it is an issue and then not really invest in you because they think you're just resting on borrowed time? But the Danielson thing, yeah. I mean, cutting to a fan who looks, you know, concerned. I mean, I've never been a fan of pretending there's a real injury in the ring. Like, to me, it just tell a good wrestling story with, you know, where all selling is meant to be taken seriously, not some selling is meant to be more serious than others.
I thought it was just, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, no, okay.
I thought it was really odd that Chris Jericho, they cut to that fan who, you know, yes. was clearly kind of pulled into the story, and then Chris Jericho just derides him as a mark. Yep. I was like, what was the point of that? You know, don't you want your fans to be invested in the stories you're telling? Like, a very strange way to approach that from a presentation standpoint.
I totally agree. I sort of, my jaw dropped when Jericho saw a fan taking seriously what Danielson was trying to get across, and I disagree with doing that as a policy, philosophically. But yeah, to then undercut it by making fun of a fan who's genuinely concerned for Danielson's well-being, but you're actually calling him what he is in that instance, in the derisive way wrestlers sometimes look down at fans, which is, ha-ha, we got you, you're a mark, as opposed to the story Danielson's trying to tell, which I will state again, parenthetically, I disagree with. But if you are going to try to tell that story, you don't want someone on commentary undercutting it in the exact moment that you find a fan who's buying it. Jericho is brilliant in so many ways, but there are times on commentary where he undercut Ricky Starks too on a Rampage several months back. I can't remember what it was, but he said something that just completely extinguished something that Ricky was trying to build up. And I don't think it's not nefarious, like intentionally mean-spirited, whatever the word is for that. But it's floppy, and it's, yeah, I don't know. I had the same reaction you did. But back to these, you know, kind of the four pillars of this, the four young pillars of this show, you know, Starks is the most ready. And what surprised me, but it was a pleasant surprise because I'm a fan of Ricky Starks. I mean, a fan of him as a heel. I'll see how much I'm a fan of his as a babyface in the AEW context now. But it was always there to be had. You know, that was a move that they could always make. And we can question whether this was the right time to do it or not. But one encouraging sign is, as soon as the fans got a whiff of the idea that Starks was not a heel and he wasn't going to be a sore loser and stomp his feet and, you know, whatever, do that normal heel act, and that he was actually kind of going to make a case for himself getting a push, they were behind him and really started cheering him instantly. And I think that had to be gratifying for him. But I am not a fan of a wrestler on television making the case after they just lost in 2 minutes to a rookie, after beating a cartoon character in 2 minutes, after a week ago issuing an open challenge and then chickening out of that open challenge against that cartoon character because he needed a week to prepare, but then beat him in 2 minutes a week later. What was that all about? Well, representing the FTW title, which is meant to be the badass renegade title. And so he puts out a challenge last week. I'm not done. I want more. Danhausen comes out. He goes, oh, I mean now. I'm not ready. Why? Why are you scared of Danhausen? Why did you issue the challenge? Who did you think was going to answer it? As Todd Martin talked about on The Fix last week. And then this week, he just beats him quickly. But what did that prove? And then he's like, give me another challenger. And then he loses. And then he goes on in the post-match to say, I brought prestige to the FTW title, which people thought was a noose, and I turned it into a tie. And it's like, well, how did you do that? You chickened out of a Danhausen match last week and lost in 2 minutes to a rookie this week. What are you talking about when you say you brought prestige to it? What is the storyline evidence that that's the case? Or are you saying in a breaking the fourth wall type way, I was entertaining as FTW champion and made it relevant again through a abbreviated open challenge series where I didn't even really play a badass and there's not a lot of logic in what I did. So I mean, maybe someone can explain it to me and make it make sense, but to me, it didn't make a lot of sense. And it ended with that sort of kayfabe breaking, fourth wall breaking promo that, well, I'm too talented to be held back. And it's like, well, you just lost in 2 minutes. What, this isn't the time to talk about how held back you are.
Yeah, I think it was entirely fourth wall breaking. I don't even think there was any attempt to make the stories that they've told with him and the FTW title jive with what he was upset about. He was clearly talking about some, you know, off-screen perception of his that he was being held back, despite, you know, feeling like he's more talented and just as deserving as other people who have been getting more television time and mic time than he is, because he brought up that, you know, basically he wanted to be able to have more to say than he could fit into 40 seconds. And so I think that was very much you know, a fourth wall attempt, or, you know, fourth wall breaking attempt. And I think the crowd kind of quickly caught on to that, because as you said, they ditched the, you know, the boos and quickly got behind him before, you know, the assault from Hobbs. So maybe it worked to an extent, but there really was no effort made here to be consistent with his character, you know, going back months or, you know, even more than a year since he's been holding that title.
Yeah. I'm not a fan of fourth wall breaking in general. It's you know, there's exceptions you can point and go, hey, that really worked, or hey, that didn't backfire in the moment. I'm just not a fan of it as a rule, as a general practice. And it just wasn't the week for to have him lose the way he did after beating a cartoon character, and then have that be the moment he turns babyface after they finally give him a heel vignette before the match. It felt kind of jumbled and not ideal. All that said, I don't know that it's going to matter, because I think breaking the fourth wall or talking in reality, fans really, I think, do like Ricky Starks. And I think he's going to be a good, just as he was a good old school heel promo, I think he's going to be a good old school babyface promo in terms of delivery. I just want the content to not include gripes with how he's booked. You know, like, let's stick to what you're doing as a wrestler, you know, from opening and closing credits on the wrestling show, and let's stick to that going forward. But I kind of like the idea, and I think being attacked by Hobbs, I want a backstory for that. I want to know why. I want it to make sense. And then have some good matches, and then move on from there. But it's going to be hard, I think, to gain momentum as anything more than a mid-card, newly-turned babyface fighting your ex-tag partner, having only beat Danhausen after chickening out of fighting him last week, despite issuing an open challenge, and then losing in 2 minutes to Hook. And Hook's badass, and he's not damaged, and there should be no shame in losing to him, but it's still not the ideal way to then instantly turn babyface if the goal is for him to ascend to a major player on that roster, and I think he should. So I just ended up with mixed feelings after that, and I knew I was like, okay, I got to process this and kind of weigh the pros and the cons, because I think a lot was going on there, not just with Starks, but also a really big moment in the book.
There's a lot going on, period, on these shows.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, that's one of the issues that that we run into a lot when you're trying to parse these stories. It's like Tony Khan is spinning like 50 plates. And, and you know, some of them break. And I think his response is just to add more plates and try to, you know, and just leave the broken ones on the floor. Like there's not a lot of attempts to sort of circle the square, so to speak. Like programs get dropped, threads get dropped, and then people end up doing other things that don't really jive with what they were previously doing, or they don't address or conclude stories all the time, or, you know, some people operate for weeks without really any character or story development at all. And I think we're starting to see some of the effects of that kind of creak into both Rampage and Dynamite, where I don't know what the solution is necessarily, you know, whether it's a team of advisors or a booker or something. But I think Tony Khan is showing the signs that he may need some help keeping this show and this many characters on the rails at times.
100% agree. And I think that's been a theme for all the time Dynamite's been on the air. I mean, I think it is not something that's getting better, and I think it might be getting worse. And part of it is just sort of the embarrassment of riches of having access to buy Ring of Honor. And, oh, let's bring Rush on. This would be a great match with Moxley. And I just – and tell me if you disagree with this, Jake, but I think Tony Khan spends his week thinking, what would be a great match that the people on the internet who praise me are going to praise me more for booking?
Yeah, I think that might be a part of it. You know, the more you listen to Tony Khan describe, you know, his fandom of professional wrestling and how deep it is and how far back it goes, I think he's like a guy who spent a lot of time on wrestling forums and is obsessed with wrestling history, who suddenly found himself in a position of being, you know, the second biggest wrestling promotion in the United States. And it's like a kid in a candy store, you know. I don't think there's a lot of restraint happening
No.
when it comes to the booking. And so, That's what sticks out to me. And it's probably something, you know, if I found myself in a position where I had a lot of money and the ability to run a wrestling promotion, I'd make a lot of these same mistakes. But I think there's, you know, there's good faith criticism coming from people who genuinely want AEW to succeed. And I think a lot of them are saying the same things, and they echo what you and I are talking about now. There's just too much happening, too many characters, and it's all probably too much for one guy to try to hold together.
Would you feel good about saying 8 weeks from now that they chose Hook, Dante, Starks, and Garcia and capitalized and built on what they did tonight with those four and did so on pretty much with all four or three out of the four every week on Dynamite? Like, there might be a week where one of them doesn't come across as having been a focus of Tony Khan's attention that week, but most of the time, every week, three out of the four are featured in some way where you kind of think, oh, this was the summer going into fall for those four guys that Tony Khan chose to elevate. Would you feel good about that? Or do you have reservations about one or two of them getting that kind of attention and you think somebody else comes to mind who should get it instead?
I would be a little bit hesitant to really get out in front of the Dante Martin train right now. The only reason I say that is because I think he's insanely talented in the ring, but he's like a personality vacuum. Like, there's just not a whole lot there. And adding Sky Blue, who looked equally go in the headlights tonight experience.
Yeah, I mean, I laugh because you're totally right. I mean, it's just he walked out and she just looked like somebody shoved her out there. And no one told her that she was going to be on live TV.
Yeah, and she was, you know, she didn't have her gear. She was just in some very like normal person street clothes. Like, I think it was like jean shorts and a blouse of some kind or another. So yeah, there was not a lot happening there from a presentation standpoint that made me think, oh man, they really have something here. Like, let's just keep the train rolling. And I almost felt this, and I hate to say this, but I almost felt the same way about Jungle Boy's promo.
Oh,
like, I'm like,
we'll get to that.
But
let's save that.
I think, yeah, when it came to the four that we're talking about, I would feel a lot more confident about Garcia and Starks in particular. Hook, a sort of a distant third, because I still think there's a lot to do with him before I'd want to see him featured heavily. But I think Dante Martin is very much still a project at this point. So when you say, are they featured? I think that could just mean like 30 seconds or 1 minute of a vignette, like just build characters, even if they're not heavily featured in matches on TV. But if they're still on the show and fans are seeing them on a weekly basis in some form, then I'd consider that a win.
And to me, a win is you can't take the next 8 weeks of TV, have someone edit just what each of those four do collectively over the next 8 weeks, and be able to randomly shuffle it and then have you watch it and have it make as much sense as if you watch it sequentially. And my point in that is they should be on journeys. Every week should be something we learn about them, something happens to them that is a key to then what happens next. Are they on a winning streak or are they on a losing streak? How are they handling success? How are they handling setbacks? Who are they associating with? How are the announcers framing them in terms of what the last 3 weeks means to the next 3 weeks of their career, the next 3 years of their career? In other words, I want to watch a sequential highlight film of Dante Martin the next 8 weeks, of Ricky Starks the next 8 weeks. And I want to have at least six segments over the next 8 weeks that if I watch them in order, it's clear they go in that order because thought was put into it. It wasn't just, wouldn't it be cool if they had this match? And isn't it going to be an exciting match? And isn't the crowd going to chant, this is awesome? I want to know their story. And I do think it's more likely we're going to get that with Ricky Starks than the other three. I will say with Dante, I think he's not a good promo yet, but he is improving. Like, he's gone from, I am like Ethan Hawke in Dead Poets Society when the camera's on him at the beginning to closer to Ethan Hawke at the end standing on the desk. Like, he is gaining some confidence to be on camera, looking at the camera, and seeming like he believes what he's saying. And I think that's promising, and I build on that. And he's just so spectacular in the ring. And I do think he has a really good look. I think there's kind of – it's like with Ricochet you know, there's going to be some Ricochet comparisons in terms of, like, you just don't forget his athleticism, but I want them to work on that personality, and I think they are, but I need more than him just sort of expressing anger. Like, give me a story, you know, give me a little more complex, nuanced layering of who he is, and that, like you said, can be just a vignette about, you know, Dante talking about what happened last. Like, I just want AEW to reflect a little more and plan ahead a little more and have that sense every week that I'm watching. It's not just a sugar rush this week, but it's reflecting on what happened in the past in order to make what happens next seem important. And those, again, I don't want to overplay these four because it could be happenstance, but I'm sort of hopeful. And I watched, I'm like, it's almost like there's a new four pillars for 2022. And it's a good, if nothing else, an exercise in framing expectations that I think would be reflective of improved booking by Tony Khan if he builds on these four, if that's his intent. Okay, with long opening segment. I can't believe we've gone 25 minutes. Doesn't seem like that. Hopefully to listeners doesn't either. But let's pause and formally introduce ourselves in the show. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, July 27th, 2022. And I'm Wade Keller, the host of the program. The editor, publisher, and founder of the Pro Wrestling Torch Weekly newsletter. This week's newsletter headline, Vince McMahon retires, in big font. It's one of the bigger stories I've covered, and encourage people to go VIP, and they can read the newsletter in the kind of newsletter layout on their tablet or desktop or laptop, or they can read the text version on their phone or their laptop too. It's up with a three-page cover story on the Vince situation. A lot of questions answered that a lot of people are asking, and just a good overview of things. As we know, there'll be even more developments as we learn more about the circumstances of his sudden retirement just days before an MSG show, which means he would have liked to last another week and he couldn't. There were forces stopping that from happening because he absolutely, I'm sure, would have loved to have been at MSG for one final time. So we got that up for our VIP members, and encourage you to check that out and go VIP, pwtorch.com/govip. We'll tell you all the benefits that come with VIP membership. And then also I edit and oversee the pwtorch.com website with daily news updates, my live TV coverage of Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown, Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays, and links to our podcasts and so much more. So hope you're checking that out. And then I also host this, The Post Show, and the Wade Keller podcast. Yesterday's Wade Keller Pro Wrestling podcast, our Blue Logo show, featured PW Torch assistant editor Zach Haydorn. And we talked for 2 hours and 40-some minutes. 2 hours of that is free for everyone on our Wade Keller podcast feed. So check that out. Almost, well, entirely dedicated to the Vince McMahon and Triple H being appointed head of creative situation. And then in the VIP after show, we talked about how this affects AEW and also talked about the Ring of Honor pay-per-view and whether Tony Khan splitting his attention to Ring of Honor for weekends like that is ultimately counterproductive, even if ROH does a good buy rate, because it takes his focus away from AEW, where sometimes he seems spread thin. That is the VIP after show, another benefit of being a VIP member. But the first 2 hours in-depth on Triple H and Vince is available right now. So hit refresh if you haven't yet on the Wade Keller Blue feed and check that out. The other voice you hear on today's show is Jake Barnett, and he is a prominent contributor at ProWrestling.net, both in their written reports, including tonight's Dynamite show, and on podcasting with Jason Powell, the head honcho over there. Jake, great to have you back on the show as co-host.
Always a pleasure, Wade. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So tell people a little bit about what you do at ProWrestling.net and also how they can follow you on Twitter. And then after that, I promise we're getting right to phone calls. And we're going to begin with Javier. We won't go as long as normal. He's on limited time, and I want to get his thoughts on tonight's show. But then we've got a number of callers in queue, so stand by because it won't be too long for you guys once we bring Javier on. And I was late getting back to a couple on-site correspondents. I'm still hoping they get my email and are able to call in once the Rampage taping is over. We had a couple people volunteer from Worcester, but just due to some travels, I was late getting back to them. So stay tuned for that. I hope we do hear from them after the Rampage taping. But Jake, to you, tell people about your contributions and how they can follow you on Twitter.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Barnett Jake with two T's, and over at ProWrestling.net, I do live TV coverage. This week it was AEW Dynamite, as it is most weeks, and I also join Jason Powell for the ProWrestling.net weekly audio show, which is the flagship podcast for members. And I also join him for pay-per-view audio reviews for both AEW and WWE. And if you're curious about hearing more from me or from Jason, who you've probably heard on Wade's other shows, you can find that out at pwmembership.net.
Awesome. All right. This is weird, but we're going to get right to Javier here. People who only listen to like the first hour of these shows for some reason don't get to hear this very often, but here we go. All right, Javier Machado joins us. He is a PW Torch contributor. He is busy covering the G1 with the aforementioned PW Torch VIP podcast lineup, or did I mention it? Well, we have a lot of VIP exclusive podcasts for our members, and one of them is the New Japan Pride podcast hosted by Javier. Javier, welcome to an unusual time slot here. I'm a little thrown off. I'm scared I'm going to just sign off on the show when I'm done talking to you here and forget about the rest of it, but welcome.
Hey, Wade. Hey, AJ. How's it going? It's kind of weird to be on before midnight, too. I thought the Daniel Garcia, Daniel Bryan match was probably my favorite match I've watched this week, which is saying a lot, considering there were two really good main events in the G1. It had this really cool, like, old-school vibe that I remember, like, on the like a Ric Flair match where he's like gnawing on the guy's face and just like the cruelty of going after, you know, something that, you know, that's like verboten that you shouldn't be doing this. It just felt really old school to me. I'm going to offer a weak defense on Jericho. Cause since I just today also caught up on, finally like 100% caught up on Rampage. And so I've been hearing him a lot of commentary. He basically calls everybody a mark. So I don't think it meant it as the, hey, he's a mark for believing this is real for the, in more like, oh, he's a Daniel Bryan mark. So he's worried.
So
for,
it's a generic,
know, Daniel
so it's
Bryan.
It's a generic, typical fan insult that is his go-to line. It wasn't meant to be, look at that mark buying the fake shoot injury to Danielson. However, I still say Jericho should not maybe choose that moment not to use that term, considering, you know, how it comes across.
Or not use the term. That's why I said it was a weak defense.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I think that context is important to bring up. It's not in Jericho's defense. It's a weak defense. But yeah, it's not like he brought that term up for the first time ever to make fun of somebody buying an injury that Danielson was trying to make people think was real. It's just his go-to insult. But it just was ill-timed this time.
Yeah, the one I was surprised at was how they handled the Roosh thing, because I had mentioned earlier in the week that when I found out that the match was happening, I was like, wow, there's no way this is going to have like a clean ending. Roosh is known as someone who does not like to do the job, and considering the fact how this turned out that he lost, not only that, like immediately, like the attention on him was cut off when with Jericho coming out. And then you forgot all about Roosh. So I find it interesting with, you know, if this were the WWE, I would be thinking, is this a test, a message sent to Roosh or not?
You know, I've talked to people who have dealt with Roosh and dealt with his aversion to doing jobs and kind of the out-of-date immaturity of understanding how this business works, according to the people I talk to, their view on it. I happen to agree based on what I've heard. And I too was wondering if this would be a situation where he's like, well, out of respect to AEW, this national platform, you know, a million people seeing this match and it's Mox, I'll play ball, you know, and maybe it's contextual, you know, maybe it has to do with who he's in the ring with and under what circumstances. I don't know how well that holds up over the course of his career, but maybe this felt like this is American national cable television against a world champion. Of course, I'm going to not feel there's any shame in passing out. It's also, if he's old school in a certain way, when it comes to doing jobs, he might also be old school about the fact that he didn't tap out, he didn't get pinned. And maybe he can just, you know, claim in whatever context it satisfies him, that he can claim in whatever context it satisfies him that, well, the ref made an early call and I would have broken the hold or something like that. Whatever he told himself, at least we got a clean finish, as there should have been. Jake, did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, he does have that reputation. You know, I was happy to see that the match had a conclusion that didn't, because, you know, they had the interference before they went to the actual finish. So I thought we were on our way to some nonsense, but thankfully they went in the other direction. But I'm hopeful that, you know, Roosh has matured and that this won't be as much of an issue going forward. And maybe this is the start of accumulating some evidence that it's not such a problem.
Yep. Javier, thank you.
Yeah, because if he could play ball, he's definitely a great get. Because, I mean, he definitely has a presence. He's got the physicality. He could be really, really good. It's always been my concern because, I mean, he turned me off. I mean, I stopped watching ROH because of him. Because it wasn't just that it was just the way that he was winning was like he was essentially burying everybody on the roster. So I was, you know, so I'm, that was my issue with him, when they signed him. But I mean, if he plays ball and he's, you know, good, I mean, that is definitely a very good signing. I just, you know, the concern is that he should be higher up, you know, he should be someone who's higher up on the card because he is a, you know, great personality, but you know, that I would be worried about putting him there for that reason. Like when he's told, you know, let's say they give him the TNT title, it's like, you know, when he's got to lose it, is he going to be, you know, is he going to play ball? But, you know, but yeah, so I mean, if this is what he's willing to do, I'm positive on that. So
I'll add too, during commentary, Regal said he scouted Roosh for his former company, but they went higher him because, and I thought he was going to go because he has a reputation for not wanting to do business and do jobs. And I was like, there's no way he's going to say that, even though that's probably exactly why they didn't want to hire him. And he goes, no, because he was too physical. And Ross said, well, that's not a problem in AEW. But I was totally like the world froze. And I'm like, are they really going to talk about this? And then they gave a kayfabe answer. So.
Yeah. So just one thing, if you just brought up Ross, surprised that Ross was out from the beginning. Well, I guess it started with an actual championship match, but do you think the experiment's over or?
I don't know. I haven't asked anyone about it. I was kind of hoping Tony Schiavone would come out at the start of the second hour and come out to music, you know, like some other college theme song that nobody, you know, from his alma mater or something, just as sort of a riff on Ross, or come out and join him and then complain about not getting an entrance theme. But I don't, Ross can be a little prickly, you know, when it comes to being made fun of in that way, you know, or, you know, being the butt of playful humor. I don't know if Ross would, if that would have made for good television, but he might have gotten a kick out of it. I might be underestimating that, but I was hoping for that. I don't know what to make of it other than maybe they wanted Ross out there for the Moxley match. Jake, did that come across to you, or was that noteworthy for you?
Yeah, I it didn't stand out to me. My favorite Jim Ross moment of the night was him looking at the name of Miyu Yamashita and just deciding to call her that young lady, because there's no way he was going to try to say that on television.
And by the way, that young lady is a term you use. I think it's a lame term and kind of outdated sounding, but it's what you say to a 9-year-old girl at a gymnastics competition. Oh, look at that nice young lady with her. It's like, you don't say that about a grown woman. But anyway, but that, you know, Ross is Ross. He comes from that generation. But yeah, that is funny.
I actually disagree with you that way, because I think that if the person you're talking about is half your age, you can call them young lady or young man. So that's pretty much what I
think that is a fair alternate rule. But I remember as a kid, Greg Gagne would do color commentator sometimes, and he was like 35 years old, and he'd talk about like these kids. He'd talk, oh, this kid really has a good upside. And I was like, you know, 9, 10, 11 years old, going, well, that's not a kid. That's like a 25-year-old guy. Like, it always weirded me out when grown men were called kids. But yeah, so it's always kind of struck me as weird when you use kiddie language reserved for children for professional grown athletes. But I understand it's just kind of part of the language.
All right, I got to get back to work, guys. So thank you for having me on. And check me out on the New Japan Pride podcast if you're following that. And check out the primer for SummerSlam this weekend. So.
Awesome. Javier, I feel like I have so many more questions for you, but you've got to go, so we'll let you go. Thanks.
Have a good one.
Yep,
you can email me, Wade.
Absolutely. Or just you know, call. I'll remember my questions and for next week or something. All right, cool. So we have our on-site correspondent joining us, one of them, Sergio, who's in attendance tonight, so we'll get to him. And then our callers, please hold tight. We'll get to you after that. Sergio, welcome. Is this a good time to bring you onto the show?
Oh, yeah, it's a good time. It's a good time. We're just cruising on home, listening to the show on the Bluetooth, so we're good to go.
Love it. I love it. First of all, what was the attendance like in the building tonight?
The attendance was pretty full. I mean, I looked at it. I was looking up and down, and I saw scattered seats here and there, but, man, it was a packed house. They were packed pretty tight in here. Like, there was a couple seats maybe in the upper area, but when I say a couple, I mean, like, a couple. And then scattered throughout the arena, you saw a few. And then there was, like, right around the hard cam, there was a few rows as usual. But it was pretty packed. It was pretty packed. And pretty energetic for pretty much the whole show, so it was a pretty good crowd.
Yeah, I got a lot of questions for you, and Jake will chime in too in a moment. It would be hard for me to determine who was the most popular wrestler on the show, and but Jon Moxley and Bryan Danielson bookended Dynamite, and I'm kind of curious if you got a sense in the building if one of them, and I know they were on at different times of the show, and you know that can distort, you know, sway things a little bit, but was it clear to you that one was more popular in ring entrance and more popular during the actual action than the other, or was it just sort of tied for mega over?
It was pretty tied, to be honest. If you made me choose between one of the two, I would say Moxley, and I think it's because he's more interactive in his entrance. You know, he comes to the crowd, he's, you know, going crazy in the crowd, pumped up, the song, people sing along to the song, and gets really loud. But like, so for the entrance in the arena, it seemed like Moxley was, it was a little more loud in there for Moxley. During the match, they were both pretty, you know, pretty over. It's, you know, the two of the biggest stars in the company, but I would give the slight edge to Moxley, but it's a slight edge. Like, they're both super over, and everybody was really happy to see Danielson back in action.
Also, we talked earlier in the show, and you're probably in the building still or making your way to your car, about kind of four young pillars on this show, in Dante Martin, Hook, Danny Garcia, and Ricky Starks. And I know Ricky Starks was like 10 years on those, the other three, but in terms of being on the national stage and getting a push, he's in a similar boat. How did those four compare in terms of how invested the crowd seemed in what they either did or said?
Let's see. Dante, I felt like it was pretty dead for Dante. Like, during his interview, like, he had his big reveal that Sky Blue was going to come out and be, like, his manager, and everybody was just kind of like, sure, okay, I guess. And he's
I don't
not,
think Sky,
you know,
sorry, Sergio, I don't think Sky Blue's parents thought it was a big reveal. I think they thought it was just a reveal. But go ahead.
It was a reveal. It was real. And Dante's not, you know, the greatest or the most charismatic on the mic, but when he's in the ring is when he shines and when people are into him the most. I would say Hook, everybody felt like Hook was going to be me and my cousin even said before my cousin came with me to the show, like, oh, this is going to end with Hook accepting a challenge at the end of this, similar to the way Danhausen did last week. But we just didn't think the bell was going to ring. Like when he made the challenge, like, hey, let's, you know, I still have a little bit left in the tank. I don't know if it came through, but they were chanting pretty loud for Hook. And then the music hits, and the place went bonkers. And when I say bonkers, I mean, like, Moxley-level bonkers when his music hit and he came out. And then when he won the title, it just went. It was one of the biggest pops of the night, and I would say it – almost mirrored Moxley's and Danielson's pop, which is kind of wild. Ricky Starks, you know, he started out in there as a heel, and so the crowd booed him like they were supposed to, but I feel like as soon as he started showing some babyface tendencies there, as soon as, like right before we went back on air from the interview, he grabbed the microphone from Shivani and he said, as soon as this goes live, you know, this is about to go live, but I just want you guys to know I'm trying my best. He's like, I'm doing everything I can. I'm trying my best. And he sounded really emotional. So the crowd started chanting Ricky right there. So you could see, like, his baby face turn there. And when he was ready, when he gave the okay, like when his promo felt like he started to turn on the babyface face side, everybody was chanting the, you know, Ricky, Ricky, Ricky. And they were into it. They were into it. And I feel like Ricky has a real high upside just because his promo work is so awesome and top tier. And he has the charisma, the entrance. Like when he played the guitar on the belt is always so awesome. And Ricky is just, the crowd was ready to accept Ricky for a babyface. And I'm sorry, but I forgot who was the fourth one.
Ricky, Dante, Hook. Oh, Danny Garcia in the main event, getting the big win over Danielson.
Oh, Danny Garcia. I felt like it was more shock in the building when he actually won. My cousin said, my cousin turns to me and he's like, oh, Danny Garcia's in the main event. He's in a lot of main events. And I turned back to him and I was like, yeah, but he never wins. You know, he's always there to, you know, put in a good match and say, hey, we had Danny Garcia on a main event of Dynamite or Rampage or Big Match. But he never wins. So when he actually won, I felt like it kind of shocked the crowd. And everybody was, like, super surprised and didn't really know how to react. And I think some people even didn't realize that he won in the beginning. And there seemed to be some confusion. So I'm not sure when it comes to him. I mean, he gets the big pop because he comes out in the beginning with Jericho's little tagline of sports entertainers and stuff. But it's a little more hard to gauge with him because he is heel. And everybody was just shocked when he won. I feel like everybody was just looking at each other like, did that just happen kind of thing. It's a little hard to gauge that compared to Hook winning the title and the crowd, you know, jumping up and down and throwing babies in the air and whatever the heck else was going on in there.
Was it obvious to you, and I guess this depends on kind of where you're sitting, that Jake Hager had grabbed Danielson's leg that led to the finish?
Oh, it was super obvious. We had really good seats. We were like four rows back, and we were facing four rows back on the floor, and we were facing the ramp. Like, we were looking straight at the ramp and in the ring. So we were pretty, the hard camera was on our left. So we saw, it was pretty clear that somebody grabbed Danielson's leg. Like, it was pretty clear. Somebody in a black hoodie just comes up from under the ring, grabs his leg. Everybody saw it. But nobody knew it was Hager because he was under the ring. But it was pretty clear, especially from where we were sitting. Everybody was like, oh, somebody grabbed his leg. Somebody grabbed his leg. So where we were sitting, it was pretty clear.
Jake, let me throw to you for a question for our on-site correspondent, Sergio.
Yeah, I guess at the end of the Guevara and when Conti and Anna Jay were attacking Sky Blue after that match, it seemed like the whole building kind of died a thousand deaths until Kingston and Ruby Soho showed up. Was that as bad in the building as it appeared on TV in terms of nobody? It seemed like everybody checked out once Anna and Ty got in the ring and started doing their thing.
I think saying it died a thousand deaths is selling it short. I felt like it was maybe 10,000 deaths that died because people were not into that at all. It did get pretty quiet in there until Eddie Kingston came out, and you know that Eddie gets his chance throughout. Eddie's one of the loudest too. Like, he gets an Eddie chance. But oh yeah, like when they did the whole brawl and Anna Jay came back, and even Anna Jay, like, her promo, I felt like people didn't know how to react to it because she was, like, saying that she was sexy and she would choke people out and screaming. And it seemed kind of forced. And it felt like the people around me, maybe it was just me, was just rolling in their eyes. I was just rolling my eyes at the whole thing. Like, this seems like such a put-on. But, it was pretty dead in there for that segment until Eddie Kingston came out to make the save.
By the way, did people react to Sammy Guevara? Like, if you had never, if you just hadn't gone to wrestling shows for 4 years and you just dropped in this arena and watched the show, would you come away with the impression Sammy Guevara is a big star and really over and a big deal, or more kind of upper mid card or something else? Like, what's the crowd reaction in Worcester for him?
Honestly, Wade, I'm the wrong guy to ask this question. I cannot stand Sammy Guevara. I've never gotten the appeal. I don't like the way he carries himself. I've never enjoyed him from Lucha Underground on down. It's almost like a joke, inside joke between me and my cousin. Like, I can't wait till Sammy Guevara just goes to WWE already, so I don't have to watch him anymore. But, like, I'm not the most partial person to ask, but to me, it didn't seem like they were treating him like a big star. Like, I mean, when he makes out with Tay Conti and, like, you know, he gets a reaction and he sticks out his stupid tongue and kind of gets a reaction. But, and besides that, it really didn't feel some kind of, like, for those other young guys who you were saying, like, there felt more of a spark and a connection to Hook and Ricky Starks than there did to Sammy Guevara, at least from where I was sitting, through my extremely, extremely biased eyes.
Jake, do you want to ask another question?
Yeah, I'm curious how the Jungle Boy promo was received in the building, because they were doing pretty rapid cuts to people in the crowd that were kind of chuckling, but it didn't sound like the reactions were terribly loud for some of the humor that he did. So what was your take on how Jungle Boy came across in that promo segment?
Whenever he swore, he swore a lot in that promo. Like, there was a lot of, like, when he started the promo off calling him, I'm not going to say it, the P word, like, that got a gasp from the crowd. I think that's what was going on when it came to the crowd. They were more gasping at, like, oh, Jungle, and you heard the jokes, like, oh, Jungle Boy is Jungle Man now, like, you know, cussing and all this stuff like that. But honestly, like, his jokes and stuff like that, they kind of fell kind of flat a little bit. And then, like, when he was talking about digging up a hole for his dad or something like that, it was hard to hear at some point just because people around were talking. But it just didn't seem too well-received. But whenever he swore, everybody was like, oh, and an audible gasp. And everybody surprised to hearing Jungle Boy cussing and swearing and calling Christians all kinds of names.
Interesting. Yeah. Was there anything off camera that jumped out to you or that you can share with us that we didn't see?
Well, I already brought up the Ricky Starks. Like, before we went live, he actually said, he was like, guys, before we come back from commercial break, I just want you guys to know, like, I'm trying my best. I'm trying. I'm really trying. He said something along those lines. And when he said it, and he was in the crowd, he was in the ring and he was emotional, it was almost like a tell for at least the people in my section, like, whoa, that sounded like a babyface thing, you know, like saying he's trying and whatnot. So that kind of hinted on what was to come when they came back from break. Tony Khan came out before Dynamite and after Dynamite, very energetic, very, you know, his dorky energy that he has, that's so, like, he's like the lovable dork that loves wrestling, and he just gets you into it. He really gets you into it, and he makes you believe this is about to be the biggest show ever. So, like, Tony Khan had that where he didn't say nothing in particular, just how happy he was to be back in Massachusetts and in New England, and it's one of AEW's homes because their second Dynamite ever was in Boston, Massachusetts, so they're happy to be back in Massachusetts. Besides the Tony Khan and that Ricky Starks thing and, you know, Justin Roberts doing, I listen to the post show all the time, so I know Justin Roberts, like, you know, he plays with the crowd, looking for signs and stuff like that. Besides that, like, there wasn't much off camera that I can recall anyway that happened, nothing noteworthy besides that.
Jake, anything you want to bring up?
No, nothing else really. Oh, yeah, one more question, I guess. So there was the handicap match between Swerve and then Tony Nese and Sterling, and it sounded like you could have heard a pin drop when Nese made his entrance, but I'm more interested in what happened in the post-match with Josh Woods attacking Keith Lee backstage. Did they show that on the big screen in the arena? Because it looked like Swerve finally realized it when he looked at the big screen, and then they had the post-match angle play out there.
We were looking at Swerve celebrating, like in the, we're looking at Swerve in the ring and paying attention to what was going on in the ring. They didn't show what happened backstage until Keith Lee was already down. Are you saying that they showed Keith Lee being attacked on TV? Like, was he showed being attacked, or was the first thing you guys saw Keith Lee just laid out?
No, I think the first thing we saw was Keith Lee laid out too, Wade, unless I missed something.
That's the first I saw of it too, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so the crowd, it was, you know, Swerve was there, and then you look up to the screen, and, you know, they show Keith Lee laid out, you know, showing why he's probably not out there, and nobody really, not even I, didn't even realize who it was who attacked him. We saw he had the title in his hands, but that was about it. I didn't even recognize the guy, to be honest with you, and it didn't really get much of a reaction. It got more of a, oh, like, that's where Keith Lee is. He's laid out by this guy, and everybody around me was just trying to talk to see who it was. At first, some people thought it was Brody King, but then they're like, oh, that's not Brody King, and it was more of people trying to figure out who that was that attacked Keith Lee at that moment.
Yeah, it was Josh Woods, but Excalibur had to explain to the TV audience who it was, too.
Yeah. Not surprising.
I wish we had Excalibur explain it to us who he was, because I saw him and I'm like, I have no idea who this person is.
There's a little too much of that sometimes on Dynamite and Rampage in AEW. Overall, did it seem like the crowd was just like satisfied with the show they got? It wasn't, you know, it was bookended with Moxley and Danielson. Thunder Rosa defended a title. I mean, you can see on paper it felt like a solid star power episode of Dynamite. Jericho was out there. But, you know, did it just seem like the crowd was into it and satisfied, or otherwise?
No, the crowd was hot. The crowd, it felt like I wanted to stick around from Rampage. I really wanted to stick away around for Rampage because there's a lot of stars that we did miss that we were hoping to see. But I live in Connecticut, in a further part of Connecticut, so it's almost a two-hour drive to get home. So I was like, let's get out of here. If the show was in Connecticut, we would have stuck around until the end of Rampage. But from Dynamite itself, it didn't seem like anybody was disappointed or, you know, the show felt lacking or anything like that. The crowd was pretty hot. Besides, like, the Thunder Rosa match, that match kind of died a thousand deaths too, to be honest with you. But everything else, I felt like the crowd was pretty hot. The crowd was responding. Like you said, they bookended the show with Moxley and Danielson, the Hobbs turning angle was hot, and that whole segment with Ricky Starks was hot. The crowd seemed more than happy with what they got. Personally, I was looking for FTR and Wardlow and a couple of, you know, my other favorites, but overall, it was a good show, and it felt like the crowd was very much satisfied with what was delivered for sure.
Have you been to other AEW shows?
I've been to AEW's lone trip to Connecticut. It was in Bridgeport a few months back. And me and my cousin went, and we had an amazing time, and we loved it. And we saw a show was coming to Massachusetts, and we said, hey, it's about an hour and a half, two-hour drive. Let's go. You know, like, anywhere in Connecticut is half hour to 40-minute drive for us, so that's a little easier for us. But we were willing to travel for an AEW show just because how much fun we had in Connecticut in that Bridgeport show. It was a ton of fun. And I'm an AEW day one guy. My cousin has been AEW for a long time as well. And we're excited about the product, and we watch every week. So if AEW is within shouting distance, usually we're going to make an effort to go, especially in Connecticut. So, yeah, it was our second show, and it was a ton of fun.
Awesome. Jake, any closing questions or comments for Sergio?
No, I think he answered everything I had. Thanks.
Awesome. Sergio, thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you, Wade, and I appreciate it. And everybody go VIP, because I am, and I don't regret it.
Awesome. Thank you. I really appreciate the endorsement. Have a continued safe drive.
Take care. Have a good night, guys. Bye-bye.
If you want to be an on-site correspondent like Sergio just was, you can email wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. Put the city and date in the subject line. It just kind of helps me stay organized and find you and respond to you when we get closer to the show. So I appreciate everybody who does that. By the way, I don't think I gave the phone number out. So if you do want to get in line on the phone, on the phone lines, you can. The number to call is 347-215-8558, 347-215-8558. When you call, push 1 on your keypad, and we'll bring you onto the show. We have a lot of emails that we'll get to. It actually, just glancing at subject lines and a couple of emails, it looks like it's going to be a good diverse mix of topics coming up in the mailbag segment of the show. But first things first, is a sort of backwards Wednesday. We go from Javier, who's usually at the end of the show, to our on-site correspondent, who usually comes after we take some calls. We'll now begin taking some calls. We could go full backwards and do mailbag and then get the calls, but more people would probably drop off who are on hold, and they'd be mad. And we don't want that. All right, so let's move to our first non-on-site correspondent, non-PW Torch VIP contributor caller of the day. And we'll head to an Alabama area code, 205. Go ahead and state your name and where you're calling from.
Hey, James Z from Birmingham, Alabama.
You said Jay-Z?
James Dean.
Oh, James Dean, gotcha. Yeah, James, thanks for calling. What's on your mind about Dynamite tonight?
Just again, Tony Khan, everything you guys said I agree with. You know, they ruined really good segments. I mean, why not have Taz come down there with his guys and his son, you know, Hook, and, you know, and then Hobbs text Taz or, you know, do something. I know he wants to go solo now, but anyway, there's just a lot of good storylines and things they missed out on that would make more of a, you know, pop or impact, and, you know, as far as storyline goes. I tell you what, I watched the ROH Briscoe's FTR review, and I'm thinking to myself, well, why can't that translate into AEW Dynamite or a show or storyline or promo package? And but anyway, also, I don't know about you guys, but Dan Lambert needs to come back, like a good heel faction going and helping guys on the mic and cutting promos. You know, there was just a lot of moments where they just, I mean, like you said, a lot of things just not making sense at all. Like you had last week, Jung Boy comes out, you think Luchasaurus is with Christian, and could have gone either way. Like you have Luchasaurus like walk off, you know, confused, like who should he be with, like, and have a match where Jungle Boy versus, you know, Christian versus Jungle Boy to, like, who wins his services or who's he could team with, or, you know, does he go heel, does he go babyface? But what a waste. And I did like him going heel. But anyway, they turned him back around, babyface. Didn't make sense at all. And then you saw the storylines tonight and not making sense. And anyway, it only hurts AEW. And Tony Khan, I think, needs to pipe down, you know, just like make comments about Vince McMahon saying he's the longest CEO now of wrestling. I mean, you got Billy Corgan and others out there, and he really needs to respect the sport and others and Vince McMahon. But, I mean, every time he opens his mouth, he only hurts himself. And, I mean, the company's not even there yet, that full potential. And I'm excited for Triple H and Stephanie to see what they do with where WWE goes now in the future. And I just feel like Tony Khan he's doing his own thing and really dropping the ball. I know guys are coming, people are coming back. They're that have been injured and everything, but you know, learn how to do storyline, learn how to do promo package, learn just like tonight, Thunder Rosa. Who watches her? They need to put the belt on somebody else.
James, I want to pause. I'll come back to you, but I'm losing track of what you began with, and I had things to say about each one of these topics. Let me hit a couple of them, and then we'll come back to you.
All right.
Thank you. Yeah. One of the main things you brought up is the Luchasaurus Jungle Boy angle, and we can step back and look at the decision to have Luchasaurus team with Christian and then turn on him. And we were waiting for an explanation. And the explanation was from Jungle Boy that Luchasaurus was just making sure no one got to Christian until I came back and got to him. Two things. Do you like that? Do you buy that they were thinking about that all along? And I guess a sub question to the second question is, can you recall anything about the Luchasaurus-Christian dynamic since they were together that would contradict that framing tonight of Jungle Boy?
Well, I guess the only thing that seems to contradict it is, you know, he adopted a different color gear. He went black, which typically symbolizes at least a change in character. So it was plausible that he had made the decision to switch alignment to heel. And then he also was using
He was committed to the con, you know.
Right.
That's
true. But I guess there's never been enough characterization of Luchasaurus to indicate that he would be, a deep thinker or in on a con. But I think the other thing that may have convinced people that he was working against Jungle Boy was that, you know, he had a squash match where he used a variation of Jungle Boy's snare trap finisher as sort of sending a message to Jungle Boy, so to speak. And so I guess it seemed like sort of a knee-jerk response to come up with this vague, you know, he was just keeping Christian safe so I could get my hands on him when he got back. That it felt like a retcon of sorts where they just changed directions and they had to find a way to sort of to paint backwards and make it seem plausible that this was where they were going all along.
Yeah. How about James brought up, I want to say not Danhausen, Dan Lambert. Do you miss him? Do you think he should be a more steady presence on Dynamite?
I don't have any, you know, special love for Dan Lambert. I think he was a competent heel promo, but he often went on these really bizarre, like, misogynistic tears that I was never a fan of, you know, whether it was Ty Conti or even further back, Brandi Rhodes, where he would just go for the shock jock kind of promo that would get a rise out of the audience, but never really told a particularly coherent story. I think when he's at his best, he can be a serviceable heel manager, but I always found that it just kind of felt like they were shoehorning one of his promos into the show because they do like those moments where they could make the audience gasp, as evidenced by what they've been doing with Christian and Jungle Boy the last couple of weeks.
What about the Tony Khan tweet when Vince McMahon retired? What was your reaction to Tony Khan's tone and words quickly declaring himself the longest running CEO in pro wrestling, which isn't really even true, depending on the parameters of you have to have X number of viewers per week or something to count. But what did that make you think of regarding Tony and his judgment or choice in that moment?
I would have left that one in the drafts. You know, I think the only real benefit of sending that tweet is getting a few meaningless likes and retweets on social media, you know. And I guess, you know, his defense would probably be, well, I had a plug for Rampage at the end of there, and if enough people like and retweet that for the other content, then they also see that I have a television show that night. But I think you know, the negatives more than outweigh any kind of positives that you could ascribe, you know, to that tweet. It just came across as sort of crass and beneath his position as a leader, you know, if that's how he fashions himself. I think, you know, the gravity of what Vince McMahon had done, you know, sort of, I would have kept my mouth shut because I think, you know, that moment should have spoken for itself.
And, you know, like with the Big Swole tweet too, like plugging your show on Twitter in the context of acknowledging someone, you know, a personnel issue or the most powerful, longest running major promoter in history retiring, regardless of the circumstances, you know, a forced retirement, to sort of be snarky, gloat about it, and brag about, you know, a stat that you don't even know, like, is he seriously proud of that, or is he kind of like being self-deprecating, like, well, you know, there's not we don't normally we don't last very long because now I'm the longest, and then it's not even factually true. I forgot what I was gonna going with that, but I don't think it does a lot of good in that context to then plug your TV show. I think that's where it's going with it. It's just tacky. Like, it's a really big story, and you can plug Rampage in your next tweet, but the idea, like, that is a strategy for viewership growth. You think, if I see something controversial and snarky that, you know, people who like me are going to like, but I'll also plug Rampage or Dynamite, well, that makes it worth it, and it's good business, and maybe that'll add some viewers to the show. I think it takes away more from the – not the mystique of Tony Khan, because I won't say it's a mystique, but it takes away from just the professional image of him. I groaned when I saw that. I didn't like it.
Yeah, I don't even know if his Twitter is even intended to cultivate a professional image. You know, like he very rarely tweets out much aside from, you know, plugs or some kind of glib and snarky reaction to some news story. And so I don't know. I wish he would use his Twitter to do what you're describing, which is cultivate, a personality that may sway more people to pay attention, because you don't grow your influence by continuing to pander to the same audience over and over and over again. You know, Twitter is a platform where you can actually change people's perceptions of you, and I don't think he does that very regularly.
And I don't think there's anything sincere that Tony Khan probably could say on Twitter that is worth saying in that moment. And what I mean is, I think either he feels the way he feels about Vince McMahon, he wasn't like his biggest fan. Obviously, his passion for wrestling lied in other places. And so, but given the magnitude of Vince's career, you either look like you're kicking someone when they're down, and you might think, well, he deserves to be kicked when he's down, and you can make that case, but that's not really Tony Khan's place. There's no real way to come across as classy or dignified, and obviously, it's not necessarily his goal, but what purpose are you served by either putting out a phony congratulations for a really successful run? I don't think people look to Tony for, like, perspective on Vince McMahon, the good and the bad, in a tweet. So I didn't really craft, like, what I think the ideal non-phony, because I don't think people want Tony to be, like, false pretense and phony. So I haven't really drafted what I think would be a genuine tweet from him in my mind. But I do know the one he did, I felt, is going to turn some people off or rub people the wrong way or confirm some people's thoughts about him that aren't positive. And I just don't see anything to be gained from that other than affirming your image that you believe you have nothing to lose and there's no rules and you can just kind of say what you want. And as long as there's a good wrestling match on the next show, it's all is good.
Yeah. Vince McMahon retiring is one of those, like, you know, shifting the orbit of the planets sort of moments for the industry that Tony Khan works in, right? I mean, it's one of the biggest stories in the history of people reporting on and talking about professional wrestling in the sense of social media. And so I think if you're Tony Khan, you just have to wait for an opportunity where you can address it with nuance. And I don't think 280 characters is ever going to provide you with that. It rarely do you see very concise nuanced comments on Twitter. And usually when you do, it's somebody who has typed out like a 15 or 20 tweet thread and posted all at once, and nobody reads the entire thing anyway.
I sometimes read the entire things, but yeah, I don't think most people do. Something along these lines, though. It's a big day for the industry. You know, regardless of how, or there's, you know, wide array of opinions about what Vince McMahon contributed to this industry, but he was a major force as the, and not the longest running tenured CEO, but as a leader of a competitor to WWE, I look forward to the next challenge that the new regime provides. Just some pithy, edited down version of that would have been a way to acknowledge it, not be phony, not compliment somebody who's going down under a shameful scandal. You don't want to like act like, well, we're all in the old boys club and I'm going to speak up for him and not think about the women. You don't have to do something that looks like you're apologizing or excusing him or looking at his accomplishments as a bigger deal than what he is alleged to have done to these women. But you can acknowledge a fact, which is he was around for 40 years and the biggest influence, and then kind of just go, hey, let's see who's next. Bring on the next. You know, there's going to be new people with new ideas, and we look forward to competing with them in spirited competition. There was room for something classy that I think would elevate him and make people think, you know, he's a classy guy who's ready for this new era that, as you say, you know, this news is changing the orbit of everything. So anyway, was there anything else that James Dean said, Jake, that you remember that you wanted to comment on, or else I'll throw back to him?
Honestly, I can't recall everything he said, so you're better off throwing back to him.
So, James, I'm going to throw back to you. We got other people, but on hold a while. So just go ahead and just, you know, give us another quick question or topic, and we'll cover that and then move on.
Yeah, they need to get rid of the FTW belt. I mean, it's not even legit. It's not even, you know, and I just can't believe the – I mean, I understand Taz because he brought it from ECW, but them trying to really – put over that belt like it's a real title. It's a joke, and like I said, I'll keep saying it till, you know, whatever. But they need to learn how to do promo packages and promos and different things. But they need to get rid of the FTW title or bring in a AEWI title for, you know. What's it called? You know, the short guys aren't big, but it's anyway, like a title for the short guys, not the, you know, if you're over a certain weight, you know, you have the lightweight title or something. But anyway, yeah. get rid of the FTW belt.
All right.
It doesn't mean anything.
Thanks, James. Some good topics there.
Yeah.
The FTW title. I mean, it's part of the makeup of a company with too many titles. And I say that, and I believe it's objectively true, not really much up for debate. I mean, some are like, more titles, the better. But it is just kind of almost a parody of itself. When now, you know, we get the weekly introduction of a new championship. You know, there's just, what next week, what title are we going to see on AEW television referenced or brought to the ring or promised a tournament for that we haven't seen before? I mean, it's I don't think it's meant to be comical. I'm sure it's not meant to be comical, but it is. Is the FTW title, in particular because of that context, something that just shouldn't be on TV, acknowledged in any way by AEW, where they actually, like, you know, essentially sanction a defense of it? And, you know, they can say, well, it's a rogue title that isn't officially recognized. Well, I'm sorry, it is officially recognized. You know, it was introduced, it was defended on Dynamite. One person won a match, kept the title, and then someone else won a match and took the title. It's as acknowledged in most meaningful ways as the AEW interim title or the TNT title. Do they do a good enough job, Jake, explaining that, or is it just watering down what it means to be champion in pro wrestling and in particular AEW by even having it around?
Yeah, it's a title that I think few people would miss if it went away. I think Hook might be the natural person to just retire that thing. Like, you know, he can defend it on Dark if he wants to, he can defend it on Rampage if he wants to, but when he's serious about going after the the TNT championship or, you know, whatever other singles championship they have him challenge for, then he can just put that thing, you know, back on the mantle at home, and his dad can be proud that he was the last holder of it, and it can be done with. I don't think it adds a lot of value to the show. I think it may add some value specifically to Hook, just so they can kind of play up the lineage of it, and he can use it to sort of, you know, as a prop to elevate himself over the next, you know, 6 to 12 months until he's ready to do something else.
All right, very good. Let's move on to our next call. You can get online if you haven't yet, or give us a call, 347-215-8558, and push 1 on your keypad as you listen to the show. If there's a topic we bring up that you want to respond to or add your thoughts on, you're always welcome to push 1 during the show if you've called in, or call in if you're streaming the show otherwise. All right, Greg from Kansas City is up next. Greg, thanks for calling. What's on your mind about Dynamite tonight?
Hey, I'm doing great. It's been a great conversation. I enjoy these discussions when they're extended like this because it gives me more to talk about as I listen to the conversation. I thought the show was solid. It was between the main segments, the main event, which was a very good match. You guys are going to talk about it later, so I won't talk about it now, but I thought the Christian Jungle Boy segment was really good. And the news with that Ricky Starks, it was a solid show, and the rest of it was kind of there. I don't know why that handicap match had to go two segments with Tony Nese and Smart Mark and Strickland. But I thought it was a solid show by and large. Wade, I wanted to pick up on something you said earlier, though, because it gets into my feelings about some of the things that are going on. And you mentioned sometimes it just feels like a company where a guy is just putting on these dream matches just to see how the crowd reacts to them. And that was one of my criticisms of, like, Black and Gold NXT, is that it was like this project to put on these great matches and get the adoration of the fans. Big difference being in Black and Gold NXT, they were telling stories that led to these matches. And in AEW, it's kind of just throwing a lot of stuff out there. It's interesting to see more nuanced, more critical, good faith critiques of Tony Khan and AEW that before were more prevalent among, like, people with bad faith takes who were just throwing terms out there just to criticize AEW for the sake of criticism. It's a positive development, I think, to see more of, like, this nuanced criticism as things go on. And I do feel like the man has too much on his plate. And I'll give a couple of examples. There's too much talent. I mean, like, who in the world is supposed to care about Dante Martin and Sky Blue being put out there? Who is Josh Woods, and why is he on TV now? There's just a lot of stuff going on, and it's like, I mean, it's, when it's good, it's very good, but it seems like more and more, like, things are just getting more and more maybe disjointed and chaotic and making less sense than before. That maybe that he needs help booking this thing. There needs to be people involved with this, because this is a lot of work for him to undertake all by himself, if he's doing all of this himself. And putting too many people on TV, you still have people who are, you know, debuting new people while Pac is defending his All-Atlantic title on YouTube. I mean, it's just, there's too much going on in this company, and they have the problem of too much talent, where with WWE for the longest time it's been like there's not enough credible challengers for the main event scene. In this company, there's too much talent, and people are getting lost because there's just so much to work with and not enough time, and they're still just fitting in all these new people and throwing stuff. It seems like there is some throwing stuff at the wall at times, and and it doesn't take away from the product in general. It's still solid, but it's just, there's a lot. Yeah, there's too much going on in this company.
That's part of why I approached the opening segment of the show the way I did, talking about the four, you know, potential four pillars of 2022 for AEW, or at least, you know, July of 2022, or at least July 27th of 2022. That remains to be seen how broad it is, but, you know, they have a lot of talent, but they don't have, Jake, too much talent that's over, in the sense that, that's probably not the best term to use. There's not week to week to week that consistency that this is what AEW is about. I just think a narrower focus on more consistently fewer people would make for a better program. And there's just not that – I mean, I think Moxley is treated as a big star. CM Punk was treated as a big star. Bryan Danielson is treated as a big star. Jericho is treated as a big star. So it's not like they don't give that treatment to some, but it's not even as consistent as I think it would ideally be. And part of that is because the roster is deep and there's so many fun matches to put on that just seems to be the priority. But, you know, Aleister Black just sort of in his own island, he does, you know, a vignette, and but there's not really a sense of if he is aspiring for anything, if he's any better off now than he was when he first showed up. Miro is back, but there's just no sense of momentum for him. He's just instantly just sort of another guy in the mix. And like, if you were to do a breakdown of like the tiers of wrestlers pushed in AEW, it's like 80% of the roster would be in the second tier called another guy in the mix. And you've got, you know, a half a dozen top guys, but they're not even consistently focused on. And there just is too much going on. And I mean, you know, Tony Nese, you know, Smart Mark Sterling, like there's just some people getting TV time that, and I'm not even, you know, using them in some context, but it feels like there's more energy and excitement being put into people who are maybe friends of somebody who has Tony's ear than that TV time is being dedicated to trying to take ratings and buy rates for pay-per-views to the next level. And going back a little bit, I don't think Tony Khan has built a strong support team helping him with booking. You know, I think, you know, he's got QT Marshall helping format the shows and stuff. But, you know, this started off as you know, it was meant to be a team effort. You know, on the eve of the first Dynamite, I interviewed Tony Khan on the show. And he was like, oh, yeah, the Bucks and Kenny and Cody were emailing each other all the time and we're exchanging ideas and all that. And, you know, a couple months later, he just pulled the plug and became head booker. And, you know, just for, you know, for a variety of reasons did so. Some were good. But it doesn't mean that now, you know, a couple years later, 2.5 years later, there's not room to go, let me take this company that has room to grow and find some people who can help make it fill in some of the weaknesses of the booking. And maybe Tony is very intentional and doesn't think these are weaknesses that we're talking about. But I don't get the sense there's other voices in the room that Tony's listening to going, oh, good point. Let's help me work that into my approach. Like, I just don't sense those discussions are going on. And if you're not growing as a booker, you know, by definition, you're sort of stagnant. And I'm not sure that you're going to see change unless you sign major name wrestlers. And that was sort of the crutch isn't the best term for that, because the opportunity came, you should do it. I mean, if Punk's available, Danielson's available, Cole's, you should do it. But it did sort of delay the need to address this topic, I guess, because it injected new life and new matchups and novelty into the show. But I think we're getting to the point now where we're back to a discussion we would have had a year ago or eight months ago if they hadn't gotten all that new talent. Jake, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think they are at a place where it's clear that the audience has sort of plateaued. You know, they had some really big boosts, the shots in the arm, so to speak, to their ratings with some big debuts last year around this time with Punk and then Danielson and Cole, you know, coming in. And I think that helped bring a buzz to this company that they had been lacking, particularly during the pandemic period when it was just difficult for anybody to make good television. But I think the focus now is that they need to narrow the vision of the show. They need to have a philosophy on who they're going to focus on. And it, you know, they have 12, you know, quarter hour TV segments every week. And it feels like they're trying to even subdivide some of those up to fit more and more people on the show. And that's having really no impact on the rating whatsoever. You know, it doesn't seem to matter, you know, how high quality the main event is, or, you know, whether it's a world championship match, or whether it's, you know, whether you have a returning star, or, you know, there's just not a lot of predictable or consistent growth happening. And so I think you have to, you know, put the lens on how, you know, where are we failing? What are we doing wrong? Where are we missing the boat? You know, we have this core audience that will clearly, you know, follow us to the moon and back, but we're not picking up new people. And I think, you know, the gap that people like you and I have pointed out, and you know, when I talk with Jason Powell on a weekly basis about AEW, we both sort of come to the conclusion that it's really, you know, the storytelling aspect of wrestling is sort of missing a lot of the time in AEW. And I think that's, you know, that in order to get that right, you need to do a lot of the things that we've talked about. They need to slow down. They need to focus on fewer characters. They need to make those characters feel like a big deal. And you can take lessons from, you know, ensemble cast television shows. You know, they don't often introduce 15 characters at once and expect you to follow all those threads and move those 15 characters all on every episode of TV 1 inch at a time to their destination. You know, they have bottle episodes. They focus on one character for an entire episode. You know, they do a lot of different things that wrestling might be able to adopt and make more interesting television. And I think it's just a matter of finding people, whether it's, you know, hiring television writers, hiring, people who have, you know, booked wrestling, or maybe there's people inside the company who have great ideas that are not currently being listened to. But experimentation is going to be key. But I think there are some things that that good faith commentators are all talking about basically simultaneously that is currently just not being heard or listened to.
Yeah, and it I'm not gaining optimism that it's on Tony's agenda to consider the good faith commentator's suggestions that to grow, it might mean introducing some new ideas and taking them seriously. And, you know, it's his job to decide what are good and bad ideas, but, you know, shake things up and listen to some consistent threads of criticism and, you know, take a step back and go, you know, are these good faith, valid points that might be holding him back? And I don't know if he's hearing those voices or if they're being offered up or what, but for AEW to get to the next level, I genuinely think, you know, it's going to take some new voices.
I guess just to add another point there, something that I see, you know, Tony has done a couple of times, whether it's, you know, in radio or podcast appearances, or even in some of his post pay-per-view media scrums, you know, there seems to be a lot of attention being paid to things like trolls and bots. And I think there's an inclination because, you know, he when he looks at his, you know, Twitter feed and he sees his mentions, there's probably tens of thousands of people trying to get his attention. And it's easy to point out the ones who are making bad faith arguments and saying, well, this is the kind of criticism we're getting. Clearly, I can't take any of that seriously. I just have to stick to my gut. I think it would improve his perspective, or maybe, you know, even the company in general, maybe even just wrestling companies, period, to actually seek out the people who are making good faith arguments, because I think it's a little too easy just to summarize your critics as being trolls and people who are ill-informed. And I think that's a place you can find yourself where you end up in an echo chamber, and that's not a very good place to be.
Yeah, well put. All right, back to Greg. What else you got for us?
Yeah, just a quick observation on the topic of Miro. It looks like it's going to be him and Darby and maybe Sting versus House of Black, and that could be a lot of fun. But I hope to see him in a more closer to a top spot going forward because he's so good, and you don't want to see him just not have any sense of direction because he's so good in just so many facets of the game right now. And then my other observation, I'll end with this, is there seemed to be a mix of talents who come in, and most of the talent very much seems to have very positive things to say about Tony. I mean, I know people like Athena and Tony Storm, they seem revitalized, like refreshed in contrast to their WWE runs. I think, you know, Athena's very outspoken about being able to wrestle like she wants to and all that. And so, but then on that note, I also have to ask, we've seen, and I'm on the outside looking in, so I'm no expert on this. You had somebody like Jonathan Gresham, and I'm curious, did he ever appear on an episode of Dynamite? Because I don't recall seeing him, and then he loses the Ring of Honor title with Little Build, and he's gone, and he's not happy with how things turned out. So I could see, like, this maybe this erratic, on one hand, like, just bouncing off the walls enthusiasm combined with, like, erratic and inconsistent type of environment taking place, maybe having a reaction where you'll have a lot of people who will come in and enjoy it, but then you'll have people who maybe, you know, aren't thrilled with, and I don't know, this is just my perception looking at it and not knowing on what's going on actually, but maybe not being thrilled with making one or two or three appearances on your B show and then losing the Ring of Honor title on a match that didn't receive very much build. So I wonder about that. It seems that there's and I was curious about Gresham. Like, that's a perfect example. Like, you bring in this guy who's the face of Ring of Honor, and he just immediately starts showing up on Rampage, and very little happens with him, and then he loses his title. So I just think that maybe this, what you're seeing going on here could vary from a personal level is great, and a lot of people get along with them and enjoy it, but then you're going to have your people who don't like erratic inconsistency. So that's just an observation, and I will say goodbye with that. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Greg. Yeah, I mean, the Gresham situation, it's one of those things where I would need to hear more than I have, frankly, to come down on one side or the other. Jonathan Gresham was not, you know, the face of Ring of Honor during a boom period for Ring of Honor, where you're like, wait, there's this legacy and you're not giving it its proper due. You know, I think Gresham was on top of ROH at a time when it wasn't considered red hot, and Gresham is really talented, but do you have him come in and start investing in a company where there's, you know, like you brought up Miro, it's like, I want Miro to be the focus, and you happen upon Claudio. And to me, Claudio is just a superior choice to be Ring of Honor champion, where it appears Tony Khan is taking Ring of Honor. And Gresham as the centerpiece attraction, standard bearer, world title holder, I'm not sold that that's like, it's a crazy move to move away from it. But I understand anybody's frustration. It's going to happen when somebody buys a company and you're sort of the big fish in that pond, and then you all of a sudden don't really feel like you have the say-so or the communication that you're used to. It can grow frustrating, and people definitely get frustrated with Tony. And that was, I mean, that's what Zach Cadron and I got into yesterday in the VIP after show portion of the flagship is, and you know, went pretty lengthy discussion on this. I won't redo it all here, but is just the mere existence of Ring of Honor taking attention away from AEW, causing more instances like Jonathan Gresham, where people who just frankly deserve the respect of more communication, there simply isn't enough bandwidth for Tony to give them what they deserve because he's taking on too much. So even if I feel in the end, it's Tony's call and Claudio's a superior choice to be champion, and it was a, you know, 10 plus minute match and it was good and somebody won, who, and there's nothing wrong with there being a winner and a loser, and there should never be a shame in losing to Claudio. I don't think it's worth throwing a fit over that, but I can understand if there's some baggage going into it that what happened with Gresham could be symptomatic of Tony's consistent, my perception is, the sugar rush of something new and exciting replacing the discipline and cadence of just embracing a Miro, for instance, and promoting him to his maximum and making sure you're communicating with your top guys and you have just enough wrestlers that you can communicate with them to the level that they need. I think I used this analogy once before, but like I've read, you know, like chickens, you know, there's the pecking order, you know, there's chickens, their brains can only keep track of the pecking order in their flock up to, I think, about 25 or 30. And if you go beyond that, they actually go sort of insane because they can't recall the pecking order of who's in charge, and it just leads to sort of chaos. And as a result, they cut off their beaks without anesthesia so they can't attack each other, and it's cruel, and it's just about profits. One of the reasons I'm vegan. Eat a largely vegan diet and haven't had chicken in like 12 years, even though I love it. It's just, that's awful. Okay, now I'm on a little tangent here. But my point is sometimes there's too much to keep track of, and things unravel. And I wonder if Tony is if the wrestlers sort of feel like they're not getting that communication And they get frustrated because they are eager and they are hungry and they are willing to contribute. And they get creatively frustrated because Tony's attention ends up on something else, buying another company, appearing on another company's show, co-promoting another show with another company. Meanwhile, there's this home base that's crying out for his attention, but you don't know when his attention is going to come back around to you. And so it can kind of drive you insane, like a, you know, chicken in a flock that's way too big for them to memorize the order of things. Okay, I don't know how that analogy holds up, Jake, but go ahead.
I guess there's sort of a lot, there's a lot of competing philosophies on what human beings are able to control, you know, how many things someone can focus on at any given time. And when you look at, you know, like the management philosophy for larger organizations, like major corporations, you know, they typically don't have a manager supervise more than like 15 or 20 people. Like that's considered like the maximum. And when you're Tony Khan, and I mean, I don't know exactly how many wrestlers work in AEW, but I'm assuming the number of contracted talent has to be well over 100 at this point. It's getting to the point where he can't possibly track and manage the characters and the directions of that many people, which is why I've long been an advocate of him having a team of advisors that work underneath him that maybe do some of that work. And I think, you know, whether he – you know, it's a test of a manager's skill, how well they can delegate authority and still, you know, manage a tight ship. And I think what we're seeing at this point is that Tony has been thus far unwilling to delegate some of those things. And I don't think it reflects positively on his management style. So I think Jonathan Gresham is more of an outgrowth of that, where there was probably no malice at all intended with Tony Khan and his agents, you know, or whomever is, that were failing to communicate things to Jonathan Gresham's liking. It was just, they have too much going on, and he quite literally got lost in the shuffle, and he felt personally slighted by that. And I think that's how you end up in that situation.
Yeah. Yep. Well put. All right. Let's take one more call, and then we just have so many good or so many emails, and the ones I've read are good, so haven't opened all of them or glanced at all of them yet. But we'll go to Ryan in Cumberland, Maryland. You are up. What's on your mind about Dynamite tonight?
I have a question about Daniel Bryan in the Daniel Garcia match. Do you think of a match this year that was a bigger upset? What would that match be?
Jake, anything come to mind? I don't have an instant recall of upsets this year.
Yeah, I can't think of one that would outpace what we saw tonight. I think anybody, you know, beating Bryan Danielson in AEW is a big deal, and it's especially a big deal for somebody that's as young and you know, perceptibly new to viewers as Garcia. I think he really was kind of due, right? Like, you know, they had been putting him in major television main events for months and just having him continually lose. And at some point, you're just kind of convincing the audience that, oh, this guy has good matches, but I don't really need to pay that close attention because I know what the outcome is going to be. And so you really needed a major upset to sort of jilt people out of the slumber that they might have got into, you know, when they see Daniel Garcia against a major talent in a main event. And so I'm not against at all Daniel Garcia picking up a big victory against Bryan Danielson. I just think the way they went about it might have been a little clumsy, trying to you know, thread the needle when it comes to a very sensitive topic of head trauma.
Yeah, yeah. If we set aside the head trauma aspect of it, and I think you can and still analyze the booking and the decision making, it's like we talk about Luchasaurus. Do we have faith that this was a master plan or an audible? Does it hold up to scrutiny if we went back and looked at everything Luchasaurus did since he seemed to turn heel? And does it seem like part of a master plan? Does Daniel Garcia winning tonight feel like, hey, Bryan Danielson goes, hey, Danny's really good. Let's I want to put him over. I want to be that veteran guy who puts young guys over, and he's so good. Let's do it. It's like, if that's how it happened, that's magnanimous. It's admirable, but do you want the story to be he's a guy who's loses just about every high-profile match he's had. He's good, but they haven't really developed a personality for him other than when we need a good match, we can count on Daniel Garcia. And we plug him into an ROH pay-per-view, we'll put him on Rampage, we'll put him on Dynamite. Most of the time he's going to lose, the vast majority of the time. Do you want to use your Bryan Danielson loses on television? Do you want to play that card for a guy who's been so ill-prepared for that moment, unless you have a really good story in mind for following up on this, where you strap a rocket to him, and this changes enough about how he goes about his business in the ring that now you believe he went from losing to winning because he needed that extra confidence. He needed that validation that he can compete with somebody at his level. But then if you're going to tell that story, do you want Jake Hager grabbing Bryan Danielson's leg before Danielson loses, or does it sort of unravel this notion that Ryan brings up that this is a meaningful upset? Because is it really just a fluke upset? So now you've had Danielson lose in a main event with the announcers framing it as an upset, but Garcia had to have help accomplishing it. And I do not have faith, based on Tony Khan's booking, this will be part of a master plan that's followed up on to its maximum benefit. And I absolutely hope I'm proven wrong on that. But I do know leading into this, he's been the guy you go to for good matches, but there hasn't been a story about him otherwise where this feels like an important chapter in that story. It feels like a hot shot, jaws will be dropped, Bryan Danielson wants to be a magnanimous moment. And I'm not sure that's, you know, A-level booking.
And I think it does undermine, the big upset feel when you're sort of telling two different stories in tandem for how he obtained the victory.
Yeah.
One, Bryan Danielson apparently, came back too early from a head injury and nearly knocked himself out giving a drop kick in the middle of the match. And then you also have, not only was he struggling to beat a guy who was clearly not 100% because of a head injury, he also had to have Jake Hager grab his foot and set up the finish. And so there's a couple of elements that undermine, the upset, but I think it still depends on the follow-up, and that's where, you probably have good reason to be skeptical of Tony Khan.
Ryan, what else for us?
I have a question on Jungle Boy. What do you think the secret was that potentially could get him killed that he told Christian Cage that what his weakness was?
Jake, we have some – I know it gets brought up in at least one email, the Jungle Boy promo, but we've been kind of teasing talking about it. So go ahead and address Ryan's question. I know we had the hand motion that he was smoking a joint, and there's some implication there that's supposed to feel like a shoot. What did you take from that moment that in particular Ryan brings up? Then we can broaden it out a little bit and talk about Jungle Boy's promo.
Yeah, I think they were attempting to, to indicate that, that he has maybe a drug issue. But I don't know how that will play out as being a key weakness for a match. I don't think they would seriously indicate that he actually wrestles matches under the influence. Like, that would be a very bizarre way to try to tell a wrestling story. I hope it's, some personal, private life piece of information, much like they were revealing about Christian's divorce or, the whole issue with Jungle Boy's father and that, it would crush his spirit if it was revealed publicly or something along those lines.
Yeah. I have looked at Jungle Boy Jack Perry differently since the promo when he made fun of cauliflower ears. And it was on the Ring of Honor pay-per-view, I believe they were talking about, I think it was on that I watched this weekend, that where it was brought up, like, what a badge of honor it is. If you have cauliflower ears, it means you've just been grinding it out in hard-fought battles on a mat, whether it's amateur or pro wrestling. And I was just like, how, like, clueless are you in a business, in the business you're in, to think that's a line you can use, one, to pop a crowd as a babyface, and two, to then look your colleagues in the eye when you pick that out as an insult for, I think it was aimed at Kyle O'Reilly. I was just like, I just felt like clueless. Like my jaw is still sort of dropped from that. And you can say, well, no one's remembering it. Well, it's just for me, my impression of him and what was the go-to line for him that he thought would work and how little understanding he can have of what cauliflower I stand for and the business he's in. It sort of is disqualifying of me thinking he's got good judgment or good knowledge. So I have that as sort of a, I won't call it a bias, but a foundation to my thoughts on him a little bit on the mic. And I think he's just coming across as increasingly unlikable the more they let him talk. I like, you know, your wife divorced you because you have small genitalia and that's a baby face line. Like, you can use that against like Dan Lambert if you're a baby face. But it just feels like, and granted, Christian went like deep, dark places, heavy-handed stuff, but your response is you've got a small prick. It's like, that's not like a clever baby face line. It's not really a place people go in insulting people who expect to be cheered. And it's hardly this like classy gotcha zinger when someone is talking about the death of your father as sort of their go-to. And now you're just going to talk about that. Like, I just, and even his delivery, it just comes across as not particularly endearing or likable. And I just don't think, I mean, Christian is a dick and he's means to come across that way, and it's effective. Even when he's not trying to come across that way, I think he's come across that way as a baby face, and now he's just leaning in on it and amplifying it, and I think it works for him. It's believable. But I don't like the way Jungle Boy is being produced or the freedom that he's being given. And I think when he was the shy, quiet guy with, you know, great athleticism and a nice smile, it felt like that was more marketable than whatever this feud is bringing out in him. I know the ooh, ah moments and, oh, he swore and, oh, he went there. I know that's crowd pleasing in sort of a, just this ephemeral, oh my God, that's newsworthy in moment type way. But I just don't think for character building, it's going to work with his audience. I could be wrong, but it's not just how I felt about it, but I'm watching going, how will this resonate with the audience AEW is going after? And it just doesn't fit. It's like an Eddie Kingston line maybe, but it just feels against who we thought Jungle Boy was and who I think he should be portrayed as. Jake, your thoughts.
Yeah. If you're going to go down this road of just really cruel, petty humor, it has to be delivered in a very clever way. Like almost like it, you know, it comes in the back door where it you're not expecting it at all. And then the punchline hits and you're like, wow, that was a really clever way to get to a dick joke. You know, like it can't just be, you know, just the blatant, you know, smart ass sort of way that Jungle Boy delivered all these lines on this show. And then to do like the hairpin turn of doing, you know, talking about a guy's divorce and that his wife left him for having a small genitalia, and then to pivot to, you know, a couple of years ago, I was, you know, standing in a hole digging a grave for my own father and try to go into this very emotional bit. It was so disconnected from the previous 5 or 10 minutes that it was just like, this is bizarre. When he was, you know, talking about his dad and having to dig the grave himself, and the crowd was just not reacting at all. I think they really fell on their face with that segment there.
And I feel like from the beginning they didn't want to talk about his family, and I don't know if they've ever said his dad's name on television or talked about who his dad is and why he's famous. And I mean, Luke Perry was famous long enough ago that maybe you got to tell people, or, you know, kind of goes to AEW's thing, which is, well, we're not here to tell people backstories because that's what the internet is for, or whatever, you know, the experience you bring to the show. We're playing to the informed, but like it always feels weird, you know, that he's Jungle Boy, Jim Ross is the only one calling him Jack Perry. And now his dad is part of a storyline with the assumption everybody knows who his dad was. And it's like, I guess his dad doesn't even need to have been famous to be part of this storyline, but that's sort of implied in the way they talk about him. So it just, yeah, it just, it feels clumsy and disjointed and unedited. It just, yeah, I just didn't like the segment, and you added some reasons to it. I also didn't like the fact that Christian did not interrupt Jungle Boy. The director interrupted Jungle Boy. Like, this idea that if a heel standing by a monitor and tells someone, turn my mic on and put me on the big screen, well, Jungle Boy was in the middle of this, like, really heavy issue about burying his dad not that long ago. And somebody in AEW, paid by Tony Khan, whose job is to present the show, it's inherent in how that played out that that person, because I don't think we're supposed to believe Christian had some friend who did it, who commandeered the truck. They didn't tell that story. So a director chose to go to Christian going, ho, 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 I'm going to interrupt you at this moment. Like, so I didn't even like that. Like, I just, that's just amateur hour to me when they don't think about the idea of, does this make any sense in how it's playing out? I'd much rather had Christian walk out on the stage. Now, the reason for not doing that is Jungle Boy would have charged after him the second he saw him after what he said. So I get that. So come up with a better way that Christian got on the air. But, and maybe the argument is nobody's thinking the way you're thinking, Wade, about that. That said, if it doesn't make sense, I don't care if people are thinking about it. I'll still point out it's dumb and there's got to be a better way to go about it. Okay, let me go back to Ryan. Do you have a third topic for us today, Ryan?
Final topic on the House of Black promo. Is there a story of why he said God and the devil are the same person?
trying to deconstruct and explain Malachi Black's promos isn't a sport that I play. And I'm not saying they don't make sense. Maybe they do, but sometimes, sort of like with Bray Wyatt's promos, Jake, it comes across like it's just you're just trying to use a bunch of fancy phrases and language to sound like you're deep. And sometimes I get numb to it. Maybe I should pay closer attention and think more about it. But I'm not sure that that's how people tune into wrestling. And certainly Dynamite isn't paced in a way where you're rewarded or even given an opportunity for doing that. Do you have anything to say about Brian's specific question there?
Well, you know, that whole stuff with the black mist and the growing, you know, sort of black takeover of Malachi's face. If I remember correctly, when he, I think he explained. Essentially, as the black stuff spreads, this presence takes over his life. And so that, you know, he kind of already loses me there because nothing he said on TV even acknowledges that this is the story that he's attempting to tell. And what I was afraid of, you know, Jason Powell and I talked about this when, after the pay-per-view, the Forbidden Door pay-per-view, where it was clear that they were building to a Miro and Malachi, program. It's like, oh God, it's just going to be a bunch of nonsense promos about gods and demons. And that's exactly what we're getting here. You know, I wish there was more clarity, but the fact that both of them sort of talk to themselves and deliver promos about gods or demons that we've never, you know, had the ability to even clarify what they are on TV. I kind of tune out when I see their promos. I mean, it's not that they're delivered poorly. It's just that the subject matter is so obtuse that I just kind of it doesn't stick with me. I don't pay that close attention to it.
Yeah, I think it's just meant to be spooky and have sort of an effect on you emotionally. But it's I don't know that it holds up to scrutiny. And if it does, I think it's just too cute by half in how spooky and mysterious they're trying to be with their language. Like it's, Raven would sometimes, when I'm doing it's deeper than typical wrestling fans are going to comprehend. It's like
this all ends in a fake fight in a ring. Like at some point you got to ground it in reality. And I don't think Malachi has done a good enough job of that throughout his AEW run thus far.
Yeah. All right, very good. Ryan, I appreciate the call.
Okay, thanks for taking the call.
Sure thing, yep. All right, let's try to get through at least some of these emails. There's more than we're going to get to here, which, you know, I guess it's a good thing. Shay from Brooklyn says, tonight Dynamite packed in so many angles and moments. One of my favorites in a while. Mox is doing a great job as champ. When he comes out and when he speaks, he just owns the stage. His no-nonsense babyface act really clicks, and it feels like the title means a lot to him. He got me excited for a Jericho match I didn't think I cared for. Jake, one of the big things on the show, if like Tony Khan was listening, he'd be like, why aren't you talking about the big announcement for, you know, for the stupidly named Quake by the Lake show in Minneapolis in 2 weeks? And, you know, that there's a Jericho world title match. That is a headline coming out of the show. What did you think of that announcement, and what do you think it means, if anything, for All Out?
Well, I think CM Punk acknowledged that he doesn't have a timetable for a return yet. And so I think we may be seeing a Jon Moxley title defense at All Out, unless, Punk was was sort of fibbing a little bit about his return date. But I'm looking forward to the Jericho Moxley match if Jericho plays it straight. You know, you had Moxley sort of call him out, you know, for being the king of trademarks, and it's the inner circle, it's the Jericho Appreciation Society. He's a sports entertainer, he's a wizard, he's whatever, and he wants him to cut all that out. And just, he wants the best version of Chris Jericho that he ever saw. And that's the Lionheart, from the Super J Cup and from ECW and WCW and whatever the case may be. And if Jericho plays it straight and he leaves all of the bag of tricks stuff behind, then I think it's an easy match to sort of get behind. But I have a hard time believing that Jericho will play it 100% straight, just given how all of his matches have gone over the last 6 months.
Any just early prediction on where it goes? Is it a setup for an all-out title defense between those two, or a title match between those two?
I think that's a possibility. I don't think the fact that Garcia beat Danielson the way that he did, and the inner circle, the Jericho Appreciation Society's involvement, is a coincidence. I have a feeling that they're going to be heavily involved in that match, even if it appears at first like Jericho is playing it straight.
All right. Then also Shay says, I predicted Hook would have to come rescue Danhausen from Starks and Hobbs, but what they did was so much better. Ricky's promos and energy are so unique, and I'm happy his biggest push is coming as a face. Hobbs has grown on me so much, and I'm excited for what this means for him, too. The two have great chemistry as friends, so I hope it carries over as enemies. Hook getting the FCW title was just a matter of time, and I think how it all came together was perfect timing for everyone. Hook, once again, felt like a star. Jake, you talked about Hook earlier, but in a year, is Hook a valuable top-tier talent for AEW? Is it more of a long-term project? Do you think they keep his matches short and have moved relatively slowly in the eyes of some, with capitalizing on that initial surge of enthusiasm for him over 6 months ago, because he's just, trying to learn the ropes almost literally. What's your thought on Hook's upside and the pace of accomplishing that?
I think Hook is one of the projects that they've actually done right by, because they've shown some restraint. They could have taken that surge in fan support 6 months ago and put him in a position where he was in way over his head, and they resisted doing that. And so I have to give them credit for avoiding that sort of pratfall. And so I think the FTW title is just sort of a next step in Hook's evolution that he'll spend the next 6 to 12 months in. He can be away from the spotlight where he might get overexposed, and he can continue to grow and maybe wrestle increasingly longer matches with stiffer competition, and then he'll be ready for, you know, a bigger feud. But I still think the biggest question mark with Hook is the character work. Like he clearly has a philosophy of his character, but how do you communicate that? You know, he's got that silent but deadly sort of vibe about him. But I don't think that he's sort of coalesced on a singular image for himself yet. And so I'm hopeful that will come together in that process as well. But I think in a year, he may be in a position to challenge for something like the TNT title.
All right. Shay also says, Jungle Boy admitted he used to run from promos backstage, and tonight he gave his first big in-ring singles promo. I felt he did a great job, and you can tell Christian's really working with him. Christian was great as usual. I guess, Jake, did you give your impression? I know I talked a lot about it. Of if you think Jungle Boy's on a good path or showing signs, even if it just means tweaking some of the content in terms of his delivery and attitude and approach, or are you thinking they're really on the wrong course for somebody like him?
I think, you know, he needs an editor, clearly, when it comes to the content. But I think there's, you know, there's something to his energy that's reading heel, and I don't think he's intending it to come across that way. And so maybe it's just more working with people like Christian and the other agents backstage to modify his delivery. You know, because, I mean, he has some reason to be angry, but you have to try to channel that into righteous anger rather than, you know, sort of that evil anger that I think is coming across in some of his promos. And so I think there's tweaks to the formula that need to be made. But I'm not entirely convinced that Jungle Boy is a project that needs a ton of work. I think he just needs tweaks at this point. He's clearly got some bad instincts when it comes to promos that they need to work out with him.
Then Shay says, Adam Page in the Bucks teasing reuniting right as the Trios titles are announced. Such a small segment tonight, but this is the angle I'm really excited for. Those guys work so well together, and I appreciate their little story beats. Yeah, so, I mean, again, Bucks, EVPs, centerpiece act when this company was created, and they're just an example of I don't know if Tony doesn't know how to book for them, or they're not, they think small doses are better, or what's going on with them, but they don't, they're major figures who sort of appear on the periphery of AEW TV, except when they have a big match. And I guess that's the case with a good number of AEW wrestlers. It's part of the formula. But this was, as he said it, a small segment, but a significant segment. Former world champ Adam Page, Young Bucks, you know, EVPs, big time tag team act in this company, teasing getting back together the week the Trios titles are announced. So your thoughts on that? Do you think it's going to happen? Do you like the idea of it happening? What does it mean if it does? And also your thoughts on the Trios title.
Well, they advertised the Undisputed Elite as being back next week. So we're going to have Adam Cole, and we're going to have Kyle O'Reilly and Bobby Fish. And I have to imagine that that's not a coincidence that they debuted the Trios title and teased the Hangman reunion and the Undisputed Elite is coming back all at the same time. You know, of course, in one of Tony Khan's many booking patterns, there's a new title, and now we have to have a tournament that culminates at a pay-per-view. And so I have to believe that the Undisputed Elite will enter as a unit, and that will leave the Young Bucks looking for a third, and Adam Page will end up being that guy. And I think that'll probably end up being your pay-per-view final match as well. But in terms of the Trios titles in and of themselves, they do absolutely nothing for me personally. You know, it's kind of a Trios matches are fun, but it's just, you know, it's basically the same sort of PWG style match that that we see every time the Young Bucks are on television. And it's just not my personal preference for a style of match to watch. I can enjoy it, but it doesn't ring my bell personally.
And finally, Shay says, I love the continued tease that Miro is maybe joining House of Black. I ultimately don't think he will, but I like that they're leaving doubt there. Any thoughts on that, Jake?
I have a hard time believing that that Miro will find his way into the House of Black. If anything, he'll be the holy warrior that tries to take it down. But I guess do we know when Buddy Matthews is going to be back? I know he's in Australia, but he hasn't been present for several weeks now.
Yeah, no. All right, James and Clemson, after everything that happened on Dynamite, the one thing that was still on my mind after it was over, by the way, this would be, you get 16 different answers if you ask 16 people this, was how good that Ricky Starks promo was. Even on a night that was filled with excellent promos, I truly believe that Starks is a top five guy in AEW, and I really hope this is a start of TK getting behind him. And that's the thing. I mean, all's well that ends well. Even with my critique of kind of the nonsensical way this all kind of came about, if it just means Stark's going to be protected and pushed and promoted as a babyface going forward, and that's what they need to do to kind of jolt his character after just sort of being on the periphery as a heel, I'm fine with that, because I agree. I think he's got real talent, and I also think Stark showing that fire, that my time isn't in the future. It was last month. It was last year. My time is now. I'm not going to wait around any longer. I mean, I think that'll resonate. But again, let's get back to talking about winning matches and, you know, wanting to win matches and not losing a match and then talking about how underpushed you are.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think Ricky Starks is one of those people who sort of proves the case that a lot of times it's more the performance than it is the content in pro wrestling, because very rarely do you see just expertly crafted promos, you know, that are written start to finish to be, you know, some kind of oratory masterpiece. It's more about the character and the person breathing life into the role and how they deliver those lines and whether the crowd believes that they're sincere. And I think Ricky Starks is, you know, he has that rare commodity where he talks and you are inclined to listen and you're inclined to believe him. And I think that will take him farther than any particular issue with the content of his promos. I think he's one of those guys that will succeed despite being underwritten in a lot of cases.
Yeah. Yep. All right. He also, James also says, on a separate note this week, I decided to watch Raw and I was impressed. I love how Hunter takes his time with segments. And I thought it really showed. The theory segment lasted an entire first hour. Afterwards, I listened to the PWT or the Way Keller post show, and you made some excellent points. I can't help but imagine Triple H making changes such as turning Becky Lynch. I really hope this makes Tony Khan realize how much he needs to step up his game. Hunter is not happy about what went down on Wednesday nights, and if Tony Khan doesn't start tightening these shows down now, things could get ugly for him. Go VIP, everybody. The VIP podcast last week, Everything with Rich Fan, was an amazing show. Hearing Wade's reaction live to the Vince retirement news. Thank you, James. Thanks for being a VIP member and for that endorsement. Jake, we could do an hour. We could do 10 minutes on this. Let's keep it even shorter than that, given how long the show is going. But your short take on if you think Triple H taking over as head of creative and Vince McMahon stepping down is something Tony Khan ought to take significant note of, because his entire, you know, game plan has been built around and succeeded in part off of contrasting the Vince McMahon vision and execution of what pro wrestling should be. And now his enemy, his opponent, is somebody entirely different. A 52, I guess, happy birthday, 53-year-old, Triple H's birthday today, 53-year-old Paul Levesque, who did some good work in NXT with some advantages and disadvantages compared to AEW. But do you think TK's got to change his game plan a little bit or a lot based on this changing of the guard with his main competition?
Well, obviously you have to keep an eye on it. But I don't think he should obsess over it. You know, it's one of those things where I don't think AEW's success is necessarily determined by WWE's either success or failure. You know, the AEW can grow its own audience and it can grow its own reach. And whether that comes through poaching fans from WWE who may begin to watch both brands, or whether that comes from pulling new people into the marketplace for wrestling, there's no singular way to grow. And it's not like a red ocean sort of strategy where there's a fixed amount of fans and it's you're competing, you know, for them in like a frenzy, like you're sharks or something. You know, there's a lot of people out there who don't currently watch wrestling who you can find a way to get into their minds and maybe bring them into the fold. And so I think Tony Khan should focus on his own brand primarily. I think he should focus on improving his own brand, telling better stories, making sure you're maximizing the talent that you have under your own roof, because that's what Triple H and WWE are going to be doing. You know, I'm sure, you know, they'll be paying attention to each other and seeing how the other is either succeeding or where they stumble and trying to capitalize on those mistakes. But, I mean, you don't go to work every day thinking, you know, how you're going to steal one more fan from Triple H or Tony Khan or vice versa. You go think, you know, trying to write a show that's going to please the biggest audience possible. Because, let's face it, they're not even really competing directly anymore. They're on different nights of television, and the wrestling audience seems happy to tune in 3 nights a week. And so is it a concern? Of course. Is it the end of the world for Tony Khan? No, not really. Cause I think at the end of the day, Triple H taking over talent relations and creative for WWE introduces just as many obstacles as it does opportunities. You know, like he has a track record from NXT that anybody can look at, and he had his own creative failures that I hope he doesn't repeat on the main roster. And so there's no guarantee of success. It's not as if Triple H taking over WWE is the rocket ship that's going to take them to the moon. There's no guarantee there at all.
Yeah, yeah. I just wonder how many people out there were buying tickets to boo Roman Reigns 5 years ago, and now they're like, oh, the AEW, the Salvation, I've got a place to go where I belong. And a couple years later, they're like, yeah, there's a lot that I love, but I'm open to be swayed to a third option, and Triple H is that third option with a big budget, a lot of familiar characters, and in the next couple of years, probably a few wrestlers who are currently in the AEW roster being featured really well on Raw and SmackDown. And that's where how many people who are buying tickets to Dynamite are going to go, I've been to Dynamite for a couple of years, I want to go see what Triple H is up to. But of course, this falls on Paul Levesque creating that product and differentiating what he's doing enough from Vince to, you know, win some people over. But again, yes, that's Red Ocean. All right. Chris B. in Long Island says, hi, Wade. We finally got some character development and progress with some storylines tonight. Plus, the pacing was great. The entire Ricky Stark story was fantastic, from the pre-match video to the in-ring story of his neck being weakened. And then the hook match, Stark's promo, Hobbs' turn on him were very well done. I've obviously, Chris, gone on record disagreeing with the coherence of all of that. But I'm glad you liked it. I feel like this was the first time in a while that AEW didn't just move quickly on from one thing to the next, and I really enjoyed that. They let things breathe more. So that's Chris B. in Long Island. I did like that aspect of it. That's a good point that Chris brings up, is there was a match, and then there was a post-match interview. It was, you know, ostensibly to get Ricky Starks' reaction to what happened, but in reality it was, you know, a setup for a post-match angle and a turn, and two turns, you know, Starks turning babyface and Hobbs turning on Starks, very related. And I'd like more of that in AEW. You know, if setting my criticism aside, there's still some good things structurally about that segment, from a vignette that took some elbow grease. It took some work. It established something about Ricky Starks and his persona and his character that I'd like them to apply that effort to the other wrestlers who they are determining are, you know, the top 16 wrestlers they're featuring, men and women in tag teams, and just kind of go, we need to put time and effort into making sure people know who these people are and understand what their journey is and what their advancements and setbacks are, and define that and reflect on it. And this was a segment structurally that didn't just go from one match to the next. Between the vignette, ring entrance, match, interview, angle, a lot of pieces there, and I like that, and I'd like to see more of that in AEW television's presentation. Jake.
Yeah, no, I I'm on board with slowing down and telling more stories like we saw with Starks, because those are the moments that make people. You know, you have to give people enough TV time for their presence and their personality to sink in with the audience. You know, you had a 13-minute roughly match between Jon Moxley and Roosh, and then you kind of broom Roosh out of the way to immediately go into a Moxley and Jericho promo, and then you run immediately to Starks and Danhausen making their entrance, and sandwiched in the middle of that somewhere is the introduction of the Trios titles. You know, and there's no way that the audience is going to be able to absorb all that information all at once within the first 20-some minutes of your TV show. And have it stick with them, but it's only by the virtue of having two very established characters philosophically in Jon Moxley and Chris Jericho that worked at all, you know. And then they often do it without very well established characters, and then it comes across even more rushed. And so I want more of what we saw with Ricky Starks tonight, even if it wasn't perfect. Giving him enough time to make an impression was important.
Yeah, sometimes you got to knock over some traffic cones to get to the place you want to start traveling. And I felt like we kind of did that. It was spread out, but it was also very concentrated. And if it's just to kind of get to the spot that you want to start on the new path, and a few cones got knocked over that, you know, I think were less than ideal, so be it. Like I said, in a way, all's well that ends well if they've got a good game plan going forward. As for the Trios title, John from Tennessee says, another week, another belt added to AEW. I was all for six-man tag titles a year ago, but now it seems not needed. There are just too many belts on this show. I really feel like the product has gone downhill after Tony bought Ring of Honor. Too many belts and too many people fighting for TV time. And is there any word on an ROH TV deal? If it can't get done in the next few months, they may need to somehow merge the ROH and AEW titles. And thanks for all the great content with the Vince McMahon drama this week. Thank you, John. Appreciate it. And this actually kind of ties in. Like, do you think Tony Khan didn't talk much about the ROH pay-per-view because I got your money, it was a great show, but now we got to move on and start focusing on Quake by the Lake and All Out and just get back to our business? It's kind of that way with Forbidden Door too. I do think not affirming people's purchase with taking a segment out of this show and saying, you know, for fans who supported that ROH show on Saturday night, thank you. You know, have that part of it, just like thank people for their support and affirm the right choice, and also talk about the ramifications. Most of the wrestlers on that show have been part of AEW TV. Many are just AEW wrestlers. How do you not talk about Claudio winning the ROH title if he's going to be part of Dynamite? Like, that's news. By not talking about it, having an interview with him, talking about the ramifications of it, you've diminished its value and you've diminished him. FTR, with their accomplishment, they're major figures in AEW. Why not talk about that? It's like, it's weird that they'll talk about it when they want your money, but then when the show's over, we're just on other things. So I wanted more. I wanted it after the New Japan show, but I especially wanted it after the ROH show, because so many of these wrestlers it was a significant moment in their careers. Jake, what do you think about that?
I think Tony Khan is just one of those people that's just relentlessly moving forward. Like, I don't think he spends a lot of time reflecting with his booking. You know, he would rather spend that time on, you know, developing what's happening on Friday's Rampage or Dynamite next week or Quake at the Lake or whatever the case may be. You know, he's spoken about this in the post-match scrums and in you know, media interviews. I think he doesn't see the value in reflecting, because people can just go watch the pay-per-view on demand or whatever the case may be. You know, he wants to focus on what's next, because that's the next thing he has to sell. And unfortunately, yeah, you're not doing... You know, that doesn't do much to reinforce that you're telling stories in a cohesive universe if you just constantly broom the past under the rug and characters just act like nothing happened. And unfortunately, that happens quite a bit.
We got an email on the art situation. I'll read this since we're talking about it. Kyle from Tinley Park, Illinois says, I'm going to start by saying I ordered some Factor meals after hearing your rave reviews, Wade. They are really good. Thanks for the suggestion. So cool. Yeah, appreciate that. You can find information on the sponsor of the show, Factor Meals, in the description of the show. And if you're not a VIP member, you hear Factor commercials pretty regularly. And I always look forward to the delivery day when those arrive. Moving on, I watched the ROH pay-per-view this weekend, and I really enjoyed it for the most part. I was upset about Jonathan Gresham's loss, mostly. But I more so want to hear your opinion on how it's being run right now. Like today, they mentioned ROH very briefly, but the pay-per-view featured so many AEW talents. In my dream scenario, I'd like to see an exclusive ROH roster, as it could help with AEW's abundance of talent. Right now, it's all confusing to me. What do you think is the right thing to do with ROH? As always, thanks for your coverage of a great sport. You have a lifelong listener in me. Have a good one. Awesome. Thank you, Kyle. Appreciate the everything there in the email. Jake, your thoughts on any of that? I mean, we talked about the lack of follow-up and kind of moving forward, not reflecting and emphasizing the past, but any thoughts on the best way to handle ROH given the pace of where things might go?
Well, I assume that Tony Khan wants it to be operated as a separate company. I can't imagine if ROH gets a weekly television deal on, some Discovery Warner Brothers cable network. They're going to want exclusive talent. They're going to want, quality product that they have, they can have confidence in. I don't think they're going to want, a show that Tony Khan treats like an extension of AEW. They're buying a specific product, and so it's going to need exclusive stars, and it's going to need its own stories and everything else. And so I hope it does become that, and I hope Tony Khan has has a vision for what that's going to look like. And hopefully that means somebody else is doing the most of the booking. He can maybe oversee it in some way. But yeah. I can't imagine another weekly television show where Tony Khan is doing the lion's share of the creative work, because he's already spread too thin. We've beaten that horse to death already on this show.
Do you like Claudio as the world champion centerpiece of that brand as he tries to pitch it to TV stations more so than Jonathan Gresham, and why?
Yeah, I think at least Claudio has a track record of being on national television, and he also has a look, and he has the respect of hardcore wrestling fans, who would be the most likely audience to jump on board immediately. I think Claudio was the right choice to win the championship, at the pay-per-view, regardless of whatever, HR situation they had with Jonathan Gresham.
And with Gresham too, like his story, if you look at him at first glance, there's a thought you have, which is he's the shortest wrestler I've ever seen compete against average and, the typical size wrestler. And you want to learn more. What's his deal? How does he compete so effectively? What's his personality? Why would I root for him? Why would I root against him? Are we not supposed to not address the fact that he's super, super short looking and yet really wide and muscular? Is it not okay to talk about that? Or do we, and is that an asset that we tell a story with? Well, AEW didn't get in any of that. It's just he's ROH champion and he's going to be on Rampage in a mid-show match. Randomly, and we're not going to tell you anything about him other than he's ROH champion, and you can catch up when you hear the commentary when he comes out for his match after you've already bought the pay-per-view if you aren't already familiar with him. So that's not as good as Claudio, who jumps off the screen, has been, I won't say underutilized by WWE, but poorly utilized by WWE in terms of his potential. I like Claudio in that spot better, and strategically, if Tony made the move because he thinks that'll help him sell the TV show compared to Gresham, then I get that, but it doesn't erase the communication critique from earlier. Zach in Texas says, gentlemen, I haven't finished the show yet, but from what I've seen so far, it's superb. Mox and Roosh was great. Mox's promo on Jericho asking for the return of the Lionheart was great. Ricky Starks dispatching a Danhausen and then getting overconfident and asking for another challenger, only to get mollywhooped and choked out by Hook, was the most efficient segment of the year. The Hobbs turn was reminiscent of Sid turning on Sean in 95 and was well executed. Bringing in an inherited guy like Josh Woods to team with Nice for a short feud with Swerve and Lee is good. Wood versus Lee is something I didn't know I needed in my life until tonight. We got to talk about Jungle Boy, though. I don't know if that on-air concerto snapped something loose or he's been eating Wheaties, but man, he was spitting molten fire tonight. I am fully invested in this feud between him and evil Steve Jobs. I mean, Christian. So that's Zach in Texas. Anything there you want to respond to, Jake?
Man, I don't think I'd call the show superb. I had a few things that didn't really land for me, but I think everything you mentioned is subjective, and so I can't really tell him he's wrong. But I didn't come away from the show thinking that everything was a home run. But I'm glad he's really enjoying it. That's why you're supposed to tune in every Wednesday.
Absolutely. Yep. All right. Just a couple more here. We'll wrap up with this one is short from Chris Fielder. From Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, they shouldn't play around with Bryan Danielson's concussion issues. It scares me for real. What do you guys think? Yeah, we talked about that earlier, and I don't like it. It's weird to say, but I don't like – well, that's too broad. I'm going to say I don't like when real life is brought into professional wrestling, and that's way too broad. But I just want wrestling to tell the best story they can tell on TV. And if it happens to be real or it being real gives it a boost and it doesn't conflict or undercut how real everything else on the show feels, then go with it. If you can enhance what you're doing with reality without it creating a counterproductive contrast with what the wrestlers in the segments before and after you're trying to do, because inherently it feels less real, then go for it. But once you start saying, this is a shoot, brother, or, when you start making it seem like this is more important because this is real, but all the other stuff is just entertainment, I think you have by far diminishing returns, or it's more counterproductive than helpful is a better way to put it. Even if that dose of reality jolts people a little bit, I think you don't want to make the rest of the show seem fake. And so from a booking promo angle standpoint, I agree with it, and I also agree with it intra-match. During a match, if somebody's pretending to be hurt for real, what does that say to the rest of the wrestling in this match and on the show? So, I'm for telling great stories in the ring, but don't just don't scare people. I mentioned it multiple times. When Matt Sydal took on AJ Styles in an ROH show I attended, Styles executed a Styles Clash, and Sydal took it in a way that looked like his head got snapped or his neck got snapped. And he laid there in a hump, in a just heap of non-motion, like he was paralyzed. And I was legitimately freaked out that I'd just seen Matt Sydal end up with permanent paralysis. And it was an angle. It was planned. Let's play off of the fact that AJ's, that some people have been really hurt when they took that bump wrong. And I didn't like that. It didn't make me more into the match. It took me out of the match. And I think that's what he's getting at in his email. And finally, go ahead, Jake. Yeah, sorry.
No, I didn't. The thing about it that kind of rubbed me the wrong way was the way that it was presented from commentary, where you have Danielson come back from a head injury, and he's been gone for a couple of months now, like 7 or 8 weeks. I don't know what the precise time he spent recovering was, but you have Jericho repeatedly insisting that he might have come back too early. And I mean, wouldn't that have entirely been cleared by AEW doctors? Like, wouldn't he have been cleared that he was 100% healthy and able to come back to work? Like, why would it have been up to Danielson to come back too early and risk re-injury like that? I think you're playing it a little bit too cute, where they want to play to an informed audience, but they also want you to be an idiot. And I'm just not a fan of it personally.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're right. This situation is a little more nuanced than just, hey, let's pretend there's a real injury. That was part of this, but the execution of it with the layering that they added, you had to be both well-informed and stupid. By the way, Danny Garcia earlier going, Brian, I'm going to send Brian Danielson back on vacation with his family. There needed to be pushback on that too. I don't think there was. I don't think on Dynamite they've really done a good job going, God, Brian Danielson is legit hurt. We don't know when he'll be back. Like, that's sort of the CM Punk thing. And they didn't. Danielson just sort of disappeared. You know, Regal made a reference to it or whatever here or there maybe. But it wasn't like this big storyline of send your cards and letters, hope Brian Danielson's better, and he's finally making us. It was sort of introduced this week in a prominent way. And at the same time, you have the heel going, he was on a family vacation. And I'm not sure they did enough for the average viewer that they weren't going, wait, I thought Danielson was hurt. Was he actually just on vacation? And so if you're going to have a heel put that out there, you got to have some pushback. And I don't remember that there being any pushback to this, I assume, fiction. I assume we're supposed to take it as fictional lying by the heel, not something that's like an alternate fact that should be considered possibly true.
Yeah, I think it was more, you know, he got a boo-boo at the pay-per-view, and he's just been milking it to stay home. To garden and be a vegan, or, you know, whatever the insult would be. It's a strange, you know, way for Garcia to go after him, because, you know, like, is it supposed to be a negative that he's at home spending time with his children and gardening? Like, I don't know. Like, he's legitimately, you know, I think they said more than once, you know, on the show that he wasn't medically cleared. But I don't think they ever specified what the injury was. And if he comes back, then as a viewer, even in the context of the story, I'm supposed to believe that he's been medically cleared. And somebody tells me that you're medically cleared, I assume that means he's at least a reasonable facsimile of 100%, not he's going to do a dropkick and be rendered unconscious because he came back too early. I think they just tried to have it both ways, and it just didn't work for me.
Yeah, well put. Okay, finally, JB from Detroit says, Mox cut one hell of a promo tonight and truly made me care about the title fight between him and Jericho in 2 weeks. It reminded me that when Mox is champion, he is able to make the world title feel like the most important thing on the show, whether that is Tony's intention or not. By the way, did you like Moxley saying, I'm a two-time champion? This is, don't think because this is an interim title, it's not the title. That was an interesting statement, and I don't know what to make of it, if it's kind of settle in, folks, it's, Punk's going to be a while, or if it was just more Mox firing back at Jericho with that, you know, sort of snide comment that I'm going to be the first two-time champion. It's like, well, how can you be if you win the interim title and you're not counting Moxley as a two-time champion?
Yeah, that was another kind of too cute by half promo line from Jericho that I was glad Moxley, you know, kind of kicked back at him for. Because if you're not going to count Moxley as a two-time champion, then you can't count yourself. But at the same time, you know, it's not Moxley's fault that CM Punk got hurt and that he was the winner of a tournament that crowned an interim champion. You know, he absolutely has the right to call himself the world champion until the other world champion comes back, and then they'll settle who the real one is. But I think philosophically Moxley, you know, nailed it there. He knows exactly who his character is, because it is essentially an extension of himself, and he has the confidence to declare himself the world champion, and anybody who wants to prove it otherwise can meet him in the ring. And I think that's exactly kind of what he was leading at there.
Also, after watching the Garcia-Danielson match, I'm reminded Danielson is arguably the best pro wrestler in the business. That was some of the best selling I've seen in a long time. And finally, I like the continuity of having Hook to follow Danhausen in Stark's FTW title open with their Hookhausen connection, and having Hook win with his dad's title to a huge pop. As always, love the show and go VIP. Thank you, JB. Yeah, I mean, it you know, in our critique of Dynamite, and you know, I stand by our, you know, individual segment critiquing and big picture critiquing, but there was a lot of good athletes doing impressive stuff on this show. And there's been a lot of wrestling shows less flawed than this in the ways that I think we've pointed out that seemed a lot worse because they didn't have Bryan Danielson, Danny Garcia in the ring, Moxley on the mic, Ricky Starks, on the mic. Like, there's just a lot of good wrestling and a lot of good personalities rising sort of above the big picture macro booking or some of the micro details that were sloppy to make this a show where I think some people watching were like, man, that was really a thoroughly enjoyable two-hour escape for me watching pro wrestling.
I think that's what makes the booking issues more frustrating, because you clearly have a crew that is willing to go out there and give it, everything that they have on a Wednesday night. And so, when you have the kind of accomplished technical wrestling and athleticism taking place regularly on these shows, the failure to put it in context and to give it the narrative drive that it needs to reach the next level becomes especially frustrating, because it's like, this is already very good. How great could it be if they were really firing on all cylinders?
Absolutely. Yes, totally agree. I said this last one. This is so related to Moxie. I'm going to read Mika from Cincinnati's email here. It's short. Wade, hope you're having a great week. I just had a quick question about the AEW World title. Moxley is incredibly over right now. It seems the crowds have really accepted his run as interim champion. So my question is, what do they do when Punk comes back? Does Punk turn heel? Does Mox retain when they have their match? Just curious what your thoughts are. As always, thanks for your insight. Have a great night. Are they ending up with, like, a problem here, a good problem perhaps, which is Moxley's so damn over and his reign is so effective, and he is, when you think of AEW right now, I mean, it is Moxley's company more than anybody's. Like, MJF for a while was like, the real big personality, not like crowding everyone else out, but he was, when the show was over, you're like, oh, that's a performance that sticks. And Moxley, both in the ring and on the mic, and attitude and what he represents, really is matching the vibe of AEW. And I wonder if that doesn't dictate accelerating what I think is, in the plans, which is a Punk heel turn. And if that's the case, who ends up with the merged title, so to speak?
Yeah, I think that's a good problem to have. Yeah, Moxley really clicking right now. And I think it's kind of a blessing for him in a sense, because his title reign mostly took place in empty arenas. His first AEW title reign was not what he hoped it would be. And yeah, having a second opportunity to get it right, interim or not, I think has breathed life into him, and I think that has breathed life into these television shows, because there isn't, other than maybe Danielson, I don't think there is a character that has a better handle on the philosophy of their own character than Jon Moxley. Everything that guy says feels authentic to who he is.
Yeah.
And I don't think you can really say that about a lot of other characters on the show. And I think that's what separates him from the pack and what makes him feel, like his segments are can't miss. And so I think if that continues and he continues to be as successful as he is, when Punk comes back, maybe you do a heel turn, because if anything, the Punk character is going to be incredibly bitter about the not real world champion being seen as a superstar and him being sort of second fiddle to that. And so I think it's a story that could write itself if Punk's return comes at a timetable that allows for it.
I hope under Apollo Beck's creative leadership, bring it up, Moxley, being champion in front of empty arenas, or largely empty arenas for Daly's place. Drew McIntyre had it worse. He was in Thunderdome with fake crowd noise and faces on monitors. I'm curious if because Drew reminds me, body type wise, ring style wise, quite a bit of Triple H, and I'm curious if he gets a second chance also to be in front of crowds and be whatever his authentic self is. And I'm not convinced he has Moxley level charisma in him if he is given some more free reign at all. Because that's a high bar to achieve. But I'd like to see a chance to see Drew get pushed in a good faith, focused way, babyface or heel, but through the lens of Paula Beck's booking eye rather than Vince's in front of crowds. And because it's worked out really well for Moxley, and I feel like there's a little unfinished business there with Drew, where it just feels like he's owed that because he did such a good job but didn't have a chance to have that reign in front of audiences.
I think you make that a part of Drew's story, you know, because when he initially, you know, became world champion the first time, you know, unfortunately it was at the sort of forgotten Performance Center WrestleMania, you know, when he beat Brock Lesnar. Essentially, you know, the story that he was telling leading up to that point was an incredibly inspiring one. You know, a guy who had been, you know, kind of picked as the chosen one and had fallen out of favor and had to reinvent himself and went through a lot of, you know, personal strife with his family. You know, his mother passed away. You know, he has a really sort of inspiring story about putting his life back together after a series of very difficult breaks. And I think the fact that he ended up being WWE champion during the pandemic could be sold as another one of those bad breaks that he wants to correct. And so I think there's hope that they could tell the right story with Drew again, whether, you know, he can put down that stupid ass sword and get to telling a real wrestling story again is another thing altogether. I hope they haven't typecast him as the guy who wears a kilt and speaks in a Scottish accent and swings a giant sword around, because that would be the worst thing for him.
Yes. All right. Very good. Long show. Lot to talk about. And I really enjoyed it, Jake. I appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure, Wade. Thanks for having me.
So follow Jake on Twitter at Jake Barnett, 2 T's, correct?
Barnett Jake.
Okay.
Last name first. No worries.
Sorry. See, that's why I throw to people and don't try to.
It's a long show. I understand.
Yes. Well, now people remember because of my mistake. It'll be more memorable because we drew more attention to it. Barnett Jake. And check out his work at ProWrestling.net and support them with a membership. If you enjoy Jake's analysis, he and Jason do this every week on their flagship, and you can support the fine work Jason and Jake do with a membership. So check out ProWrestling.net and click on the membership tab and subscribe and add another Must Listen podcast to your weekly schedule. Thanks to our emailers, our callers, our on-site correspondent. Good talking to Javier early in the show. And we'll talk to y'all next time. Thanks so much.